enough, we know the issue of pricing in gas, of the gas, the LPG in particular, was an issue as well coming out of this winter. Probably the industrial and commercial sector has been feeling the pinch all along, but as ordinary residents, we started, you know, opening our eyes when we're taking our 5 kg, 9 kg, 19 kg gas cylinder to go and buy gas. And then we realized that although in the past there was some decrease on gas prices, but there was another hike. Well, I'm sharing my personal experience of using gas for house, or space heating. So I'm sure I'm sharing that experience with others who go through as well. The Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry did hold a couple of sessions on the impact of electricity prices on the economy of the country, particularly on manufacturing, and very, very critical issues raised there by various sectors of the industry, and of course to us as well. And recently, the National Treasury has introduced a policy draft on carbon tax, which definitely will impact some energy pricing as well. I'm sure that not all honorable members, the list goes on, but I'm just setting the tone and the framework within which, you know, we had to come to a stage whereby we then have to, you know, address and start grappling with the issues around the energy, you know, pricing and the pricing formula, what is within our reach as a country, what is beyond our reach, particularly when it comes to crude oil. Because it's easy for people to write articles, to make statements and say government must do something. But it's important as well that while they make that statement, out of painful experience in any case, they also realize that, you know, determination of the price of crude oil, much as we can try to influence it, but it's not within our reach, is determined by global forces. Of course, I do consider that we are part of those global forces one way or another. And that's something we can discuss as well down the line. Of course, we have when it comes to electricity prices, that's definitely within our reach. And I hope all of those things that are being raised. Sharema, you are around, and you obviously will take us through the various sectors, and also the opportunity to take us through what we missed last week, because we're supposed to share with us the electric price and the, you know, issues. Having said that, several members, and I'll allow the committee secretary to take us through apologies before we get our presentation from the department.
Thank you, James. Following apologies, Honorable Lodo, Honorable Hayele and Smala, who has restricted team to commitments, and then Honorable Kumar, who is secretary. Those are the apologies.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will allow then Dr. Market to take us through his presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to present on the fuel pricing mechanism that we are using in South Africa. But before I do that, I just want to highlight some of the reasons why I think the fuel price hike that is going to happen tonight. As you're probably aware, the price of petrol on grade will increase by 32 cents tonight. This will increase by 32.9 cents. Paraffin at the wholesale level will increase by 25 cents. Single maximum national retail price for paraffin will increase by 24 cents. and LP gas increased by 22 cents per kilogram tonight at midnight. The main reason really is the is geopolitics, if you like. As the chairperson has said, the price of crude oil and the price of finished products, the supply of crude oil is really determined by what is happening in the major producing countries in the world. And some of them that had serious challenges or tensions in the previous month are mainly in Yemen, where there was a sabotage of the pipeline, and some of the prisoners, you know, there was a break, and the prisoners escaped there. There's also an issue around Libya in Benghazi, the processing to oil producing region in Libya. You know, the challenges there that could lead to supply disruption also of oil. But also in Egypt, you know what is happening in Egypt currently. But the main issue in Egypt is the fact that they are processed and that the custodian of the Suez Canal, which is one of the main conduits for the flow of crude oil, you know, to major parts of the world. So the concern that if that canal can be closed, there could be serious concern in as far as the movement of oil is concerned, because it will take a longer route to deliver oil, crude oil to its required. And also there were issues in Iraq. You know, it was stabilizing in the past few months and so on. But since 2008, you see now it's experienced the deadliest month last month. You know, there were a lot of, you know, casualties and so on in Iraq, and that also had an impact on the price. Closer to home, the issue around Sudan and South Sudan, you know, they were, you know, these issues around claims and counterclaims around the rebels and also, you know, threatening cut supply, that also had an impact on the availability of crude oil. And then in Canada, there was a major accident in Canada, a raid accident, which actually is forcing the government now to review, you know, their policy to transport crude oil by raid. So that will also have a major impact on the movement of crude oil. Then lastly, this one is a seasonal issue. We know that in the northern hemisphere, they are now moving to summer driving season, particularly July and August are their most, you know, their main driving season, USA and in Europe. So as a result, the demand of finished products like the petrol and so on increased. And this is how we have this impact on our fuel prices. I just want to highlight that here, just to understand the presentation. But yeah, the way we structure our presentation, maybe I suppose introduce my colleague, Chairperson. I'm with Mr. Hembach next to me, who's a fuel pricing specialist in the department. The next team is Mr. Nonka Dandarelli, who's working in the business office. Our colleague from electricity, they've apologized. I think they'll be running late, and they'll be joining us. This is how we've structured our presentation. We'll look at the policy position and some of the key pricing mechanisms. And look at the DFP, the rated fuel price that are using in South Africa. Then take one or two slides on the maximum refinery gate price for LPG. And we'll also talk about the IP pricing, the single maximum national retail price for IP. And then we'll leave some time because mostly we'd like to discuss and hear the views and how we can improve our pricing system going forward. To start with, the first slide really to give a production is to say there are mainly three basic forms of fuel pricing globally. You know, you can have what is known as ad hoc, you know, pricing mechanism, if you like. This is a situation where the prices are set regularly. In other words, there's no transparency. And it's very common in countries where they've got a lot of crude oil and they provide a lot of subsidization because the sale from crude oil, the revenue from crude oil could be used as subsidies for the pump prices. But of course we know that the, you know, subsidies themselves are not sustainable and somebody has to take on these subsidies. Then we have the formula base or automatic pricing adjustment, which is what we're using in South Africa, the basic fuel pricing. The formula is known, it's transparent, the formula is published, and you can see what's going to happen at the end of the month or when the price adjusted. The factors are known, which factors influence the price and so on. So that's the formula, that's the method that we're using in South Africa. And then we have the liberalized pricing system where the market forces determine the price. It's mainly happening in most developed countries like in Europe and so on. But of course, if you look at the example of Australia, we realize that even though the market is deregulated, but the authorities still, you know, from time to time, I think every 5 years, they review the import parity element to make sure that the companies and the companies that are operating in Australia are actually using the same parity when it comes to bringing the product to Australia. So there's always a watchdog, even when the price is deregulated, to make sure that there's no collusion. In South Africa, just to highlight what really the government is doing, in terms of petrol, diesel and paraffin, diesel basically we don't regulate the retail price, we only regulate petrol, but we determine all the price elements within diesel the same way that we are doing on petrol. That's why you find that in most cases the price of petrol or diesel, petrol and diesel service stations are more or less similar, even though it's a little bit of a differential, because diesel is not regulated. Paraffin, as you said, regulates the same maximum national retail price for paraffin. We don't regulate the wholesale price, and that's where some of the issues related to LPG are coming up to say you cannot just regulate the end, the end of the value chain. You should either regulate throughout the value chain. But we'll talk to some of these issues in detail. Then I'll just to say, in South Africa, we're using the import pricing like other countries that are importing finished products. In our case, it's even worse because we also import even crude oil. So the import pricing in principle, what it says is that this is the price that you will purchase the product in the international market and get it delivered in the country where you're going to use it, in our case in South Africa. So that's the price, including your shipping cost, your insurance cost, and so on, until the product is delivered to South Africa. So in our case, that would be the BFP, or the refinery gate price, if you like. But I also highlight a few principles in our pricing system. It's a deemed pricing system. Why we say it's a deemed pricing system? We know that the refineries, in South Africa, and yet when we price when we determine our prices, we do that as if all our product is imported from international refineries or international markets. But the main reason really why this was agreed upon was to make sure that our refineries are also competitive with other refineries in the international world. But also for everybody to understand that at the moment South Africa is a net importer of finished products. Close to 20% of our finished product needs is met through importation. So economists will also tell you that, the cost of the last liter or the last barrel of product that you use to meet your demand will determine the cost of all the products in the market. So the import parity pricing is justifiable in this case. Then we also have what is called the Mediterranean zone. The country is divided into pricing zones, if you like, depending on the supply point. So within a radius, kilometer radius, in 200 kilometers radius of the supply point, we'll then classify that as a zone. That's why you see zone A, zone B, 1A, 1B, and C. But the A, B, and C is really the mode of transport that takes the product to that zone. For example, the product can be delivered by pipeline, it can be delivered by rail, it can be delivered by road. Hence you have A, zone A, zone B, and zone C. So that really just highlights the mode of transportation. And then we have our transport, our pricing system is based on the lead cost mode of transport, where applicable.
And the lead cost
mode of transport is the pipeline. The pipeline is the cheapest because it can bring huge volume, millions and millions of liters at one, and then it's followed by rail, and followed by road. Road is the most expensive. But we always price based on the least mode of transport. Then we also, because the price regulated at retail level, we have what's known as a cost recovery or pass-through cost to the consumer. For example, when we have challenges with the Durban to Johannesburg pipeline, known as the DJP, at the time where it was filled capacity, there was no more space, bring other products from Durban to Johannesburg. The government and industry agreed to compensate people who use road to bring that product to Gauteng. Because road was more expensive by pipeline, the differential has to be paid by the motorists, the cost of pass-through to motorists. We'll talk about that when we talk about levies in the presentation later on. I'm not going to go through some of these similarities too many. I think we are all familiar with them. There is YPA, Petroleum Products Act, the Central Energy Fund, and so on, without really wasting time. On this slide, just to quickly define what the BSP, the basic scale of IT, as I highlighted in one of the first slides, that is based on the import parity principle. This is what it will cost a South African importer of petrol to buy the petrol from an international market or refinery, transport the product from that refinery, insure the product against losses at sea, and land the product at South African shore. So that's basically what the import parity pricing is all about. I also want to highlight the role of the Central Energy Fund that was appointed by Cabinet in 1994 as an impartial body to administer the control price on behalf of the department. That's basically what FED is doing on behalf of the department, and then the department will also then work itself on the last day of the review period to actually check the numbers, get them audited by an external auditor, before they can be announced as the field price adjustment at the time. So at the moment, the external auditors are KPMG. They've got a two-year contract with the department. I think they're coming to an end next year around June, July. Right, the main document that we use in adjusting the field price is the BSP working group, because this is the document that was agreed upon at NADEC level, Labour, government, and industry agreed on this working rule. In the working rule, it's very, very clear how the department go about determining or administering the prices on a monthly basis. So it's clearly outlined in those BSP working rules. But what I want to also highlight is that in the BSP working rule, it says the price will be adjusted on the first Wednesday of every month, and the announcement will be made 3 working days before the adjustment is made. So it does not necessarily mean the announcement will be made on a Friday. It will depend. If there's a public holiday or a Friday is a public holiday, the announcement could be made on that day. Yeah. If the Monday is a public holiday, that would mean the announcement should be made on the Tuesday. But what most people are not aware, maybe they should also read paragraph 7 of the working rule. It also says the announcement could be made on Friday or Monday. It's just that the department has been issuing the statement every Friday, so the people got used to the Friday. But if you check the working rules, there's also allowed to do that on Monday. What is also very important is the over-under recovery that occurs when you adjust the fuel prices. And I'll explain what this is and why it happens. Remember that our fuel prices are adjusted at the beginning of the month and they're effective going forward, which means we adjust our fuel prices based on historic data, if you like. For example, what we did last Friday is based on what happened in July compared to what happened in June. Then that gave us the price for August going forward. So there's always a price lag compared to what the motorists or consumers are paying in the market, and based on the actual price that are supposed to be paid in the market. Now, what is over and under recovered? In our pricing system, when we calculate, for example, now we have the BFP, the basic fuel price, for August, which we calculated on Friday. Now that becomes the BFP in the pricing structure. But we know that on daily basis, the BSP changes. So there's another BSP that is calculated on daily basis based on the rand dollar exchange rate, the crude oil prices, the petrochemical product. This daily, the average daily BSP is compared to the BSP that is in the pricing structure. Let's say, for example, the BSP in the pricing structure is 500 cents per liter, and the daily BSP is 490 cents per liter. So what it really means is that the motorist, or if you like, the refiners, are paying 490 instead of paying 500 in the market. So they are over recovering by 10 cents. Because the sell price is supposed to be 500 cents, but they are paying 490. So if they are over recovering, it means the price is going to go down. Because they are getting more than, they are paying less than what they are supposed to be paying. Similarly, if the the daily DST is 500 a cell, and the DST in the price structure is 500, it means the industry is under covering by 10 cents, which means motorists are paid 10 cents, you know, 10 cents more. Yeah, 10 cents more than they're supposed to be paid. So that's where the undercover and overcover okay. But we can discuss the data out as well. What I also have on this slide is just the important date in our fuel pricing, if you like, team. In April of every year, we start free. We'll adjust the pipeline tariffs as announced by NERSA. We'll also include the fuel levies as announced by the Minister of Finance, including the road expense fund. All those are just in April. In September, which is what we are going to now, the wages for the forecourt attendants as well as the creditors and the forecourt is adjusted in September every year after negotiation between the union and the employer. So they are dealing with the negotiation now. Usually the margins, the wholesale margins and other margins are adjusted in October, but I think for the past 2 years we've been doing it in December, and I think even this year we'll do it in November. But what is also very important is the octane differential. You know that in South Africa you have two octanes of petrol, 93 and 95. When you adjust the fuel prices, they normally go up at the same price as petrol. But in actual fact, because of the different octanes, the prices in the international market is not necessarily the same. So what we normally do is on a quarterly basis, every 3rd month, we then adjust for the octane differential, you know, which is usually around 2 cents per liter to further adjust the two. I'm going to go through these elements one by one in the next slide. But these are, if you like, the import parity elements or the DST elements. These are really the build-up to our pricing formula. But also to just highlight where we currently source our products based on the current DST formula that we use. We are mainly using the plus pricing or reporting agency that reports on pricing. So all the data that we use on our pricing is obtained from plus. But we also know that there are other pricing agencies like August, Bloomberg and so on. And South Africa decided to use plus on our pricing. Yeah. Petrol, our petrol, about 50% of our petrol is sourced from the Mediterranean, and about 50% from Singapore, according to the formula that we use at the moment. When it comes to diesel, 50% of that comes from the Mediterranean, and 50% comes from the Arab Gulf. And paraffin is also 50-50 from Mediterranean and Singapore. This is just to show you the areas where, you know, the Arab Gulf, the Mediterranean is over there, the Arab Gulf is down there, and then you have Singapore. That's where we get our product. Right, now we're going to go through the price elements one by one. I think to start with the price. The cost for the price we get from the London Tender Broker Panel, which, if you like, it's a panel or a group of brokers that are involved in transporting vessels, the costing of vessels, finished products and so on. So they really determine the prices, and that's where we get our pricing. I think there's also an issue around the size of vessels that we use. The size of vessels are really determined by our berthing capability. If you like, what is happening at the port. It don't help us to bring a bigger vessel which cannot land in our port in South Africa because our ports are a little bit shallow. So that is why we use the medium rig vessel, which will be able to dock in the South African port and be able to offer the product. But of course they are bigger vessels than the ones that are coming to South Africa. But I think what is also important on the price is that at the moment, that on top of the price, there's an additional 15% premium that is added at the moment to supply product to South Africa, which is something that we can discuss, but it's an historic number that the refiners at the time, the DST was designed or developed, they said they were paying a premium to bring product to South Africa. and then the 15% was included. Then we have insurance, ocean loss and cargo dues. Insurance at the moment is only insured, the price is about 0.15% of the free on board value and the price, so you pay around 0.5% on that. And ocean loss at the moment is 0.3%. So we know that you are dealing with chemical products and they do evaporate as you transport them from one state to the other. So at the moment it's sitting at 0.3%. The cargo dues, these are that is paid by everyone or shipper who comes to South Africa, is determined by the National Port Authority. So it's included in our pricing system as well. Then there's an element called the demurrage. The demurrage really is the time that the vessel or the ship spends in the harbor, either to load or to discharge the product. And this is costed on hourly basis. Even though the vessel might not be operating, as long as it's there on the harbor before it's offloaded, then you incur the cost for doing that. At the moment in the pricing system, we only allow for 3 days for that to happen. So if your vessel takes more than 3 days, then you must know that from the fourth day, you are not covered in the BFP. So it can only be compensated for the 3 days that is allowed. We also know that, you know, some of the reasons why some of the vessels will take longer before they offload. One, it has also to do with planning, where some of the companies import their finished product and then they don't make arrangement with the transport port authority on time, say our vessel will be arriving on this day and so on, so that the decision could be made. You know, some of these inefficiencies lead to more days where the vessel is very current to that in our harbor. Then we also have the element of coastal storage, where all the refiners are expected to have storage capacity, particularly the refineries. When they receive products, they could be able to store, or even the products that they produce from their own refineries is stored, then taken to the depots and then transported to the same station. In our pricing system, we allow for 25 days of coastal storage. So I think we need to know that as well when we get to the discussion. Dock financing, again, we allow for 25 days because we store the dock for 25 days, therefore financing should be also for 25 days. What we include in our pricing system, we use it can be any bank, but at the moment we are using standard bank. Generally, they are the same, that we are using prime rate minus 2 in our pricing system. And we believe that this is the correct one because the oil companies that are operating, they are, if you like, they are very successful businesses, very big corporate, and that's what they get when they go to any bank to ask for financing, prime minus 2%. But I don't want really to go into the numbers, they are not so important at the moment, but this is what you will find in our pricing system, in terms of the cents per liter, could be slightly 2-3 cents out, but yeah, the all costed accordingly, so that it can be easy to arrive at the pump in cents per liter. We highlighted some of the factors that affect on our pricing in South Africa because we're using the import parity pricing. We talked about the crude oil prices. It changes on daily basis. We use the average for the pricing review period. Then we talked about international product supply demand balances, which is also affected by what is happening in bigger markets like the USA, like China. We know that the USA keeps a lot of stock inventory. If anything happens to the stock inventory, say for example, America decides to draw products from their inventory stock, the price will also be impacted because they have replenish the stock and transport, and when they do that, the big demand for products in the market. So that also has an impact. What is happening in China is the economy in China starts slowing down, you see the impact on the movement of products as well. It's also seasonal. We just talked about the summer season. The season in the USA, in Europe, and so on. Because they are big consumers, when they change season, whether they go to winter, they go to summer, depending on the product that they use, it also impacts on the supply, demand balance in the market. Geopolitics, I touched on that when we talk about the what is going to happen in our parties tonight, mainly due to geopolitics, which is very, very important because these are countries that have crude oil. So if anything happens in any of those countries, you know that there will be a shortage in the market, and the market will react accordingly. We talked about the US dollar exchange rate. We must say that this time around, the rand strengthened against the dollar, and actually it saved the country around 9 cents, if you like, 9 cents a lead on the pricing. So it also has an impact on our pricing. We talked about the oil patent, or CIFNA. Chairman, I'd like to then touch on the levies, fuel levies that we have in our pricing system. Some people will know that we are supplying the BLNS countries, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. In the main, they are supplied by South Africa. But if you go to these countries, you find that their price is much, much lower than our pump price. And the reason is mainly because they do not have most of the levies that we have in their pricing system. For example, most of them, they don't have the road exit and fund, you know, which is in South Africa. Most of them, they don't have the fuel levy as, you know, the quantum that we have in South Africa. So that's really the main difference is why you find that in some countries, particularly these neighboring countries, petrol is much cheaper than in South Africa. But while on this slide, Chairperson, I think I want to bring the issue around the subsidy. Just quickly to say, subsidies are really imposed to cushion the price on the consumers in countries where, as you said, they've got crude oil, you know, and they can use the revenue from crude oil to actually provide the subsidies. We know what happened in Nigeria, for example, some few years ago, when they want to reduce their subsidies by 50%. There was almost a riot in Nigeria. Yeah. But we know that these subsidies are by themselves not sustainable because somebody has to pay for the subsidy. So most countries that used to have subsidies or use subsidies like Iran and so on, they're actually moving or trying to reform the pricing system, see how they can still help the poor without necessarily having subsidies and so on. So there's a lot of reform that is happening in many parts of the world where there's subsidization. But we also know that heavy subsidization like in Nigeria leads to cross-border fuel theft.
You know, where people...
Where people will smuggle fuel from Nigeria because it's subsidized and take it to a neighboring country and sell it there. So it's got its own positive and negative. It also happened in Turkey, for example. It's not only in Africa where cross-border fuel smuggling can happen. On the levies that we have in the pricing system, we have incremental inland transport recovery levy. This is a levy that was introduced in 2009, mainly because of the constraints on the Durban to Johannesburg pipeline, where the companies could no longer bring products to the pipeline because it was full. So we have to, and then we have to then help these companies to bring the product to the inland market, and most of them to pay 3 cents. This case, I must say, the minister, if you recall, in February, gazetted a notice in the government gazette to terminate this levy, the intention to terminate this levy. So because the new multi-product pipeline is now operational. So what happens is, from the end of April, no claims on this levy will be processed by the department. So we have closed on the claims. Unfortunately, it's necessary because of the backlog. The levy will still be in the fuel pricing system. The minister will then determine when that levy will be officially terminated. Once they've done all the calculations to say how much of the backlog we still have to pay and how much money is sitting in the account at the moment. The reason for the backlog is really because even though the levy was introduced in 2009, but the claim started, you know, I think 2007-8, because that's when the companies had the constraint of using the pipeline. So hence they are now using the backlog that we have today. Then on the petroleum product levy, this really, I think it's 0.15 cents a liter. This is used to, in simple terms, to finance the activities of NERSA around pipeline regulation as well as storage facility regulation. If you like, the petroleum regulation part of NERSA is financed through disclaimer. Unlike on the electricity side, where the budget for that will come from the national treasury. The IP tracker die, levy. This is a levy sent by the oil companies, where we have requested them. In fact, the department and staff will appoint a service provider to produce dye, you know, that we use in paraffin to make sure that people don't mix paraffin and diesel. Because that used to be the problem. You know that paraffin is zero rated, it's not taxed. You can use it 50% with IP and diesel and mix them and still use it in your car. So in order to avoid that, we are using this tracer dye, where it's good in IP. And if you mix it with diesel, then the color will change. Then we then know that you are mixing the two products. The slate levy, if you recall when we announced the first price, I'm probably some of you listened. The slate levy actually increased by over 10 cents a liter. It's one of the reasons why we are seeing it high tonight. The slate levy really is the money that is collected from motorists and is used to reimburse oil companies for cumulative under the cover. As we said, we have a pricing lag in South Africa. We have adjusted our prices based on historic data, and we set the price now for the month going forward. And in actual fact, the prices that I set in the market is not the prices that we have regulated. For example, now we've regulated the price based on the BSC. If the rand dollar exchange rate changes, crude oil price changes, and so that price could be above what is regulated or below what is regulated. So in cases where there's always an increase or under-recovery by the oil companies and it's cumulative over, say, 2-3 months or so, we find that there's money that the motorist or the department where the motorist should reimburse the oil company for cumulative under-recovery, otherwise they go out of business. So what we have done as government, this late day used to be, the time we abolished it, used to be 43 cents in the first pricing system. And at the time, there was a lot of money in the state accounts. And we advised the minister in time to say, let's rather introduce a self-adjusted slate mechanism. What it means is that the slate levy was in bigger form. It was abolished. It was taken out of the pricing system. And we said, because there was money in the state account, let's use this money to reimburse the oil company. And when this money gets to around 250 million, you know, negative, 250 million, then we can then collect the levy from the motorist. So at the moment, sometimes we find the pricing system, the late levy will go down because it's self-adjusting, or it will go up. I remember in May it was zero because there was enough money in the account. So that also helped motorists. Instead of just collecting all the time and keeping money in the balance, we said no. Let's rather have a self-adjusting slate mechanism. We only collect money if the slate balance is negative. And once it's positive, it reduces the slate levy, it goes up. Or even to a point where sometimes it's zero. Then these are the levies that are really imposed by the, if you like, by the, or are collected by Treasury. The fuel levy, as I said, is announced by the Minister of Finance and is collected by Treasury. The custom unified levy, transport is also collected by SARS. Then the road accident fund is also going to be to Treasury to compensate people who are involved in car accidents, whether you are a vegetarian or a driver or a passenger in the car, also compensated through the road accident fund. Then we have the demand side management levy. It's also collected by National Treasury. At the moment it's 10 cents a liter, but it's only applicable on 95 ULP in the inland market. So if you go to the coast like here, in Cape Town, it's not applicable. In Durban, it's not applicable. And the reason really, when we first introduced, but to really discourage, if you like, motorists in the inland market from using ULP 95 at the time. Because we were told and people were confirmed that, you know, in terms of octane differential, we are not deriving much benefit as a motorist from using 95 as opposed to 98. Because 98, the octane really, what octane does to you or to your vehicle is really the, when you move from a standstill position, the speed at which your car can move, it is determined really by the octane number. For example, if you look at the car that are involved in motor racing, the octane number is 133, 135, and you can see how the speed of when they move. So that makes a huge difference. But it's got an octane difference, differential of around 2, I mean 93 and 95. In the inland market in particular, people could not experience the difference. And we thought, I mean, to actually save octane instead of this, people will call it octane wastage. We said, no, let's discourage people from using 95. But we are aware now that most of the motor manufacturers now, they actually tell you that you must only put 95 in your car, irrespective of whether you are in the coast or in the inland market. So we know about those issues. But you also get some oil companies approaching the department saying they want government to actually increase this heavy so that we can encourage people from using 95. So yeah, this is something that we can discuss carefully. We have already, some of you might not see, unless you have a hard copy, just to show you all the elements now included in our pricing system. This is what we actually published on a monthly basis, and the price changes and so on, without going into detail. But you can see this is the last month's one, not the latest one, so we didn't change the presentation. But you can see there the threatened levies I was talking about. All the levies are there. The slave levy at the time was 6.5 cents, so it has increased by 10 cents. So tomorrow or the new, that what you'll get, it will be around, you add 10.96 there, it will be around what, 70? Yeah, around 70 cents a litre. So without going to the numbers, I think people can read for themselves. Yeah, unless there are questions, then we can entertain questions. This is just a view. To show you the composition of our fuel price, you can see about 60% of that is based on the BMP. 25% or so is the levies, all the levies combined, around 25%. And if you look at the other countries, which are more or less similar size to South Africa, in as far as GDP, okay, you realize that the South Africa is one of the lowest in as far as the levies are concerned. But if you compare now with Europe, you see that, you know, more than 50-60% of the price in Europe is equal to taxes and levies. Then we have around retail margins about 8 cents, wholesale margins about 4 cents. Now, just quickly to touch on the paraffin price. You're probably aware that the department regulates the retail price. In fact, it's a cap, if you like. You cannot sell above that price, but you can sell any price below that. We know that we have a lot of challenges around compliance on this matter, particularly in remote areas, mainly because there are a lot of middlemen involved in the supply chain to get the paraffin to where it's required, and everybody in the supply chain wants to get a markup. We have done a study when we looked at how we can deal with the margin for paraffin. In that study, it became very clear that if you want to make sure that there's compliance, we need to create what is known as energy shop, if you like, or cooperatives. In the areas where the paraffin is used, then we bring paraffin closer to communities, then we cut all the middlemen involved in the sale of paraffin. That's one of the recommendations in that study that we got. And I think this is something that we should discuss with the industry. Because as in my view, as part of their corporate social investment program, they could play a big role in that regard, as opposed to just expecting government to do something on all of these things. But this is something that we can discuss. I think there could be a way out on this matter. But in the main, the price of paraffin, this is our structure. Our concern is the retail margin of paraffin at the moment. The retail margin of paraffin changes every month when the price of paraffin changes. It's actually 33% of the wholesale price of paraffin. The wholesale price will include CST and all the costs, transportation costs, and everything that is involved until the paraffin gets to the end user. What we've done, at the moment, internally in the department, we've done a study, as I said, we've consulted, we have published. We have done public consultation throughout the provinces. Our view is that we must fix the retail margin, like we are doing the retail margin at the registration and so on, and only adjust it once every year. By just doing that, we'll actually reduce the price of Operati by around Turin. Yeah, almost up to Turin. So that's what we are going to comment, and that's what we hope and we believe that the minister will sign it off what is done. But yeah, the issue of compliance status will remain a challenge that we need to find ways together with our inspectors in the department on how to make sure that we ensure compliance. One of the challenges we also have, Chairperson, is that the sellers of paraffin, some of them are not necessarily licensed by the department. If you look at the father shops and so on and so on. Now, when enforced compliance, you normally enforce compliance in line with the licensing condition, you contract with the licensing condition, and so on and so on. So this is a challenge that we probably might have as well, to go to any spouse shop. Some of them, we don't even know them, until somebody says, that's where I bought my paraffin from, to enforce compliance. So that's one of the challenges that our inspectors also told us, to say that's what they experience when they go out to try and enforce compliance in this regard. This has the composition in another way. You can see again the basic fuel price is around 65. Look at the retail margin here, it's 25%, whereas on the BSP, the retail margin is around 8%. So that's why we want to fix the retail margin on IP checkers. The main reason really is the retail margin changes, and the retailer gets more money without doing anything to add value to, you know, to the business that is doing to supply the paraffin to the end user. So it just gets a windfall. Then finally, I would like to touch on the LPG, the maximum retail price for LPG, which the government started regulating in 2010, I think around June, if not July of 2010. And one of the challenges that we have at the moment, firstly, our private colleagues are dealing with this issue, but one of the issues that the industry is raising is that since we introduced the regulation, we have never adjusted all these elements. In other ways, in 2010, when we introduced it, they were like this and they are still like this. So the only thing that changes is the retail price, the maximum retail price on monthly basis. But the element building up to it, like your maximum refinery gate price, has not changed, you know. So that's what the industry is complaining about, you know, in Poland are looking at that. But also the fact that we only regulate the retail level, we don't regulate the wholesale level. So what basically happens, we know, some companies decided to increase the wholesale price, which then sweeps the retail margin. Because the retail margin is kept, you cannot go above what the government announced. So some of the retailers complained about this 2 weeks ago when they presented. These are issues that our colleagues in policy, we are part of the team, but it's led by policy colleagues, where we are looking at how to address these issues on the LPG price. I think Chairperson have covered the presentation, unless you want us to maybe quickly just deal with some of the frequently asked questions that we have in our website as a department. The first one we have is, why are fuel prices changing every month? It's policy of government. That's the decision that government took to change, you know, for their price on a monthly basis. So I'm dealt with under and over recovery. Why is petrol cheaper in neighboring countries? We have dealt with that one. Why is Gasol not selling petrol at lower prices? Because they produce it from coal and they are placed in an outage. That's one question that we get. But maybe to answer this question, we can say we cannot have two. You cannot have dual pricing system in one country. You know, where Gauteng probably their own price, and other parts of South Africa have their own price. We cannot have that. Government decided to regulate the country as a whole, not provinces. But also, remember that Sasol only supplies about, but in terms of the supply, it's around, now they increased to around 40%. Majority, some of it is exported to other countries, neighboring countries in particular. But you must also remember that the market share, the retail service station for Sasol is around 17%, if I'm not mistaken. Now, if, say, for argument's sake, fuel price was deregulated in the country, it was not controlled by government, and people would expect us to sell at the lower price. The reality of the matter is, they could not do that. Because if they sell less power price than everybody else, they are going to run out of fuel themselves. You know, because they cannot meet the needs of housing alone, for example. And once that happens, it means everybody else can then increase the prices because the supply will be limited, because some sort of vegetation will be dry and so on and so on. That's what the future that could happen. We know what happened in 2005, when we removed lead, you know, from our fuel, when we moved to unleaded petrol. There was a lot of shortage around the country. You go to 3 cent stations and we don't find fuel. The reality of the matter is that if fuel was deregulated, the next station that you get the fuel, you could pay even more than 20 rand a liter, because you can't take it or leave it. So it's very important that we talk about deregulation and why South Africa at the moment cannot deregulate completely. It's really a question of, do we have enough players in the market? Have we leveled the playing field? We think everybody competes fairly in the market at the moment, because we know that's not the situation. You know, I cannot import product and sell it in South Africa. I must still access the infrastructure that is owned by the oil companies. And to access that infrastructure, we know the challenges that the wholesalers are facing. So we are not necessarily ready at the moment for deregulation. That's my view. Well, we are talking on number five, why is the government not deregulating fuel prices? In fact, the regulators, I mean, not the regulators, the dealers are saying, plus, why don't you regulate the price of diesel as well at retail level? The same way we are doing on petrol, because they behave the same. They require more or less the same amount of effort when you pump a liter of diesel in a car, it's the same as you pump a liter of petrol in another car. So the dealer wants us to extra regulate it at retail level, not at wholesale level. We talk about the demand side management. Maybe that's really what question 6 is all about. Why is ULP 95 more expensive than ULP 93 in the outdate? But the cost is the same in the coastal areas. The last question, why is government not buying oil from African countries at lower prices? Certainly at the moment, government is not buying crude oil. It's the oil companies that are buying crude oil. But when you move to strategic stocks, we like government to hold strategic stocks, particularly through the strategic fuel fund. That's what will be happening. But to answer this question, most likely is to say that these oil companies are actually buying from African countries, particularly Nigeria and Angola. We have seen with the Iran situation that now the supply of oil from Nigeria and Angola in particular increased in South Africa. In fact, I think close to around 85 to 40% of our crude oil at the moment come from these two African countries, and the bulk comes from Saudi Arabia. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members.
Very good, Father Remark. Father Mambas, there you are. A very complex situation. I've noted quite a number of areas that have been raised by Mr. Marke. What strikes me, things like the reference market, you know, the Caribbean, Arab Gulf, and Singapore, and once again, how some of the areas, particularly in Singapore, which had been exposed to the drop of crude, if I'm correct, but is very, very central to determination of oil prices. And I'm glad that also you've broken down the fuel price and for us to see, you know, how the fuel price is determined up to the levy issue, because I'm sure people will observe that these days as the fuel price goes up and down, particularly increases, you know, the asset sector, particularly within the business, you know, were quite sensitive to the levies, you know, expect and academics, they really zoom on those things. But I feel, in any case, keep the government on it too. Also, on the other hand, the issue of gas, I'm sure all the members will be, you know, you will comment on that. it's a very interesting thing that there's been changes around the retail margin in particular, as well as the paraffin. Quite interesting. And I'm sure for those of us who attended the oversight visit last week, we'll be able to relate to some of the things that were raised, particularly by, we did visit the market DP, guest director here in Cape Town, and not only to go around waiting, wearing all the safety gear, but a good session sitting down with them and going through. And I remember it's very striking because, you know, you can get to the nations in a committee room, but when you go down on the seat, you know, get the same people who would come here, they were able to raise quite a number of interesting experiences, you know, on the same issues. Very, very helpful for that. But just comment from my side, I will allow members to pick up issues, questions. I have my packages, but over to you first. Who would like to give it a go? Honorable Railing.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I mean, I don't envy the department in some of it. I mean, I know that a lot of these forces are out of your control in terms of the basic fuel rights, and it's the Tehran geopolitics and international crisis. Perhaps the issue of peak oil is also at play there, and, you know, there's a bit of debate around whether it would reach peak oil or not, or whether oil impact is even the middle switch for the global economy. Given the price rise of about $150, the global economy just can't seem to happen. So, yes, we've got serious issues which we have to deal with as a country and become, and almost in a sense, try and move ourselves off oil in the long term, which is something which I think all countries are struggling with. But I wanted to explore a couple of issues. I mean, one was this issue, I suppose, was put forward, and I think it did need to operate, was this issue of trying to smooth out the increases and the decreases in the petrol price. Because I think what's really disruptive to an economy is these massive spikes in the fuel price. And perhaps we could explore the possibility of, you know, when price decreases, maybe it doesn't decrease to the same extent that it's been translated to in terms of the basic fuel price, and then we build up a fund to then smooth out the increase. Is this something that's being considered, which might help us deal with some of the volatility that we see each month in the price increases? Then just getting to the issue of paraffin. Now, this is a difficult issue. I mean, paraffin at the moment, I know, is a fuel that's used in the main by the poorest of the poor in South Africa. And for that reason, it's been VAT exempted, and we try to keep the price as low as possible. But the problem is that it exhausts an enormous cost on our economy and on our society, and in fact on the lives of the poor through sharp fires, through ingestion, all of those kinds of things, which I'm sure you're aware of. The issue is, how do we deal with this conundrum that we're facing now? Whereas it seems to be the fuel of choice for the poorest of the poor, so we want to keep it as cheap as possible. But at the same time, we actually want to try and migrate people off paraffin if possible onto other substitutes, such as gas. And I think that we need a household energy strategy that can look at how such a transition can occur without imposing major costs on the poor. And when you say that, for instance, you want to reduce the retail margin to bring down the price of paraffin, yes, that might impact on the lives of the poor. But I think, though, the first thing we need to do is we need to clean up the value chain of paraffin. That's what we should be investing in right now. Is that if we are going to have it as a fuel that is used by the poor, let's make it as safe and clean as possible. So start to enforce regulations and use some of these windfalls to, in fact, put into investment around the bottles that they're transported in, making sure that it's a sealed up bottle, making sure that the stoves themselves are in fact compliant. You know, really clean up the fuel chain as fast as possible, because I think that would be a huge benefit to our society. But then on the other side, I mean, looking at gas, I mean, what seems to be evident there is, I mean, as you've mentioned, I mean, you can't just regulate the one side, you can't just regulate the retail, because what we do there is we then start to get shortages, and that's what occurred last year, and it will occur again if we don't deal with this issue. So we need to set the proper wholesale price as well, and a price at which imports can also become feasible. And then we need to start to look at the infrastructure and kind of investment that's needed in terms of terminals to import gas. Because if we are going to have people migrate off paraffin and onto gas, then we need to make sure that we've got enough supply of that as well. So I think all of these issues need to be looked at in tandem. We can't look at paraffin on the one side, not look at a substitute as well. We need to look at how we have a proper strategy and look at a phase transition away. And I just think that the price is an important mechanism in that as well. I mean, when I look at the issue of Safcon, and I've heard this argument before, and I mean, it is interesting. Some people have said to me that what could happen if you deregulate, what could happen is that Safcon could end up dominating the market, particularly in Gauteng, and forcing our smaller, forcing out some of the other refineries. Once you get a shutdown, then you start to see a real problem in terms of security of supply. There's issues around that. But I think one of the things that is interesting to me, though, is that what you've got here is that a company using what is essentially our resource, or the country's resource in terms of coal, producing the cheaper fuel, making a kind of windfall profit out of that, and that benefit doesn't come to the fuel prices in South Africa. Now, I think that when we go forward now as well, particularly when you start to look at fracking and things like that, I think the worry is that how do we know that the same scenario isn't going to play out? How do we know that, we need our resources to be used to translate into lower prices for us in South Africa as well. And I think that, we just need to unpack it just a bit more in terms of our particular resources and therefore how we make sure that they actually translate into lower fuel prices for society as a whole and not just for certain companies.
And spend a few minutes on it because you get what I say, coming up with one position of peak oil and then there's another radical swing. Somebody saying something else, and but I think it's good you've raised it and for the department just to share that. How does what impact does it have? Would it like to have, even if there's a possibility on it? Whilst I give other members to look at this. Once again, I like your input and remark when you see market prices in Australia, people politicize. But I'm sure you'll agree with me, the oil price generally is politicized. Whether that was a real change, the politicization, I would like to see that taking place. I'm sorry, I'm a skeptic on that. Once again, another comment is that on the Australian model, it's very interesting to see that once they allow markets to set prices, they have two bodies that a watchdog that shows that there is one body that shows that there's no price collusion. You may not have the details now, but it's quite an interesting area to look into how do they ensure that there's no price collusion because they. I'm sure all of us in this room have seen recently how the Competition Commission has been growing its canines, uncovering, collusion in various sectors. And this is, petroleum sector is quite an interesting thing to see if that could be occurring in any case, whether in our country or any other country for that matter. So, suffice to say that the use of fragmented regulation in the liquid fuels, needs to be looked into. And if the status quo is to remain, surely all members would be very upset in that, Can I say 100% regulation in petroleum? Only petrol. But partial regulation, it is the unknown regulation, and then partial regulation in paraffin. Or whatever it is, I trust and hope that that doesn't have a negative impact to the economy of the country, but also not just the economy, maybe to our overall socio-economic well-being. Uh,
I see also in terms of the regulatory and policy instruments, there is a distinction between legislation and other legislation. For example, there's the Gas Act, the Gas Regulator Levies Act, there's the Petroleum Pipelines Act, and then there's the Petroleum Pipeline Levies Act. What's the rationale behind that? Because the rail gas maybe could help, but why don't we have electricity levies act? Not that I support that the distinction between the main act and the left act, but just in features that's very striking to me, you know, is it to ensure that there's, you know, proper administration of the levies or anything, would it be helped to have the composite arrangement? In terms of your imported funds, you made a sense that wholesale scale margin have had a tendency of shifting to December now as of October. The reason for that, and what's the significance? The working rules in BFP were adopted in NEDLAC. By implication, they were a product of negotiations. But throughout the relations, what you have articulated is that this is a highly administered sector. But there's one component, one number, that gets shifted to negotiations. Not a question of the outcome, but why is this one? Or, you know, what significance, you know, does it have? Were it to be just having a product of just regulation, what difference would it have made? Sort of a little bit academic, but it's quite striking. Probably the importance and value of subjecting to network forces would come out of your response. But also, just as a comment, it's striking when you look at the composition of the PSP, when you look at things like the demand in particular. The extent to which then either yourself or SAPIA or whoever engages with the port authority to ensure that offloading the honor number is done in time, because every extra delay, whether it's a few hours, means some few cents or fractions of cents extra cost for us. And the extent to which the SPM, particularly that it is the only one in heaven, would have an impact on that during high demand of electricity as well. When it comes to the slate levy, given that this is a high volume industry, and surely I'm sure even the annual turnover should run into quite a high number of billions. I mean, just last week we were told that the downstream sector is about 300 billion and an unknown. I just imagine if you extend and cover the whole sector. I'm looking at the plate lately and they say your threshold is 250 million. How did you come to that figure? As I am figured, as I said, that it doesn't have a high volume threshold. And also, I can imagine the overall sector and, you know, the contribution to the GDP. In terms of the transport costs, which come in a lot on the fuel price, you still have what you call entities, correct? You are looking at the zone differential, which is about 2%. One then, you know, comes to the area of rural area, transporting fuel to rural areas. Doesn't that have an extra cost? I'm looking at all in Congo, one of the most rural provinces in the country, and for one of the poorest. Just take us through on that. Probably not, now, but down the line, and even now, in any case, come up with end up you making some comments on that. Because the same, you know, transportation of fuel from the country is causing issues. The something that slipped, I didn't pick up clearly when you come to Barafin, your comments around cutting the middleman. How could that be done, and how? What implications would it have? Can I add another frequently asked question, very, very latest? The likely impact of upgrading the finance. It's a big issue, and let's see. We've been there, and sorry, it's going to be another frequently asked question of time. The other one is the likely impact of improving access to household appliances. Once again, that's triggered by our visit last week. It links up with one of the things that, you know, we've been raising the perpetuity, and once again, one of the raising the raising once again today, household, energy policy. But that's a comment that's mindful that they will not stop until the partner shuts off our mouth by sharing a draft policy on that area. Because time and again, issues that come up when we're dealing with various aspects of energy, I look to the fact that it is essential that we grapple with that from a perspective of developing a policy on that. I think that's fine for now. Let me hand over to Member Claire.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question which I was not here properly about the coastal storage of 25 days. What happens if the system exceeds the 25 days?
Saying that the maximum of the price at the bottom because the cost of property may be sold at any place in South Africa is 971 rand. Again, I'm just grab on the chair, just to say on partners and co-option thing. Coming from it, but I'm interested in that. Thanks.
Okay, over to you.
Thank you, gentlemen. come with questions. The one that we cannot take will indicate if that will respond in writing a person. But I think the last one, in fact, we can take it quickly. I think it's supposed to be 9.71 cents per liter. But this was an old template. I think recently it's 2041. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, the title from our side. Let's start from the beginning. I think, gentlemen, in your remarks, you talk about reference market, mentioning that Singapore and New Zealand produce a block of oil. I think these reference markets are mainly the big refining centers. Their products are refined and stored in storage facilities before they are exported to where they are required. So these are not necessarily big oil producing countries, but these countries that are invested in refining capacity, that are invested in storage facilities to be able to be hub for finished products. That's basically what I'm saying too, in this center. Reference center. This is where we get our products, not crude oil. Because remember, the import pricing is on the product. It's the price that you buy the product in the international market and lend it in the country. That's where the import parity pricing comes in. This is why we talked about the reference market, because they are not necessarily your main producing countries. These are the countries that have infrastructure as far as refining capacity is concerned and also storage. And then the product is sourced from this main center. Singapore is, in fact, one of the main refining centers in the world. Then you have Amsterdam, Rotterdam in Amsterdam. Then you have Mediterranean in Italy. Then you have Arab Gulf. We know that of late, India is a big refinery, but it's not really a refining center at the moment. The pricing there is based on what is happening in Singapore, because they don't have a lot of storage facilities. There's not much trading that is happening in the Indian market compared to what is happening in Singapore and so forth. So that's basically what we mean when we talk about the reference market. Okay, then when we...
I think it should be applicable to the rest of the petrochemical product that come out of crude.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, they have an impact.
Yeah.
You know, once there is the fluctuation of oil itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The thing on the book is what about the price promoting mechanism, you know, is it under consideration? But we must say that in the past we used to have the equalization fund, which was more or less used as a smoothing mechanism, which was discontinued. I'm sure Mr. Barker said no on why it was discontinued and so on. But it has to do with really the quantum and how much money is to be sort of, you know, used to smooth the pricing and so forth. But at the moment, I can say in the department, it's not under consideration. Unless if, you know, through the chapter and so on, you end up the department to start considering. But I must say it's not under consideration at the moment. I think I'm going to add on this one. If and then on the IP issues, we talked about safety and, you know, cleaner fuels and paraffin being fuel of choice to communities. But I think we also mentioned about, you know, moving people from paraffin to other forms of energy. You will recall that a few years ago, I think the Minister of Energy, I think at the time it was Mekundi, at the point announced that you are phasing out paraffin, and there was an outcry in the market, and that decision was reversed because we realized that, you know, with paraffin the dynamics are different. You know, people are saying even though the department is regulating it per liter, but I can take a cup and go and buy a cup of paraffin depending on how much I have in my pocket. So it's really a question of affordability as well and convenience, you know, to some of these people in the rural areas in the main. But yeah, I agree with you. The issue around safety is a major concern for us. That's why we are working with Safety Association, Paraffin Safety Association in this regard. If you get all our integrated energy centers in particular, paraffin is sold in safe bottles. Community is actually educated about safety before the paraffin is sold there. But we need to increase, you know, this awareness throughout the country and so on. I agree with you. The issue around paraffin appliances. We once, I think 4 years ago, piloted what is known as the paraffin stoves. in four provinces. But he had a high lot of around. If I get the number correct, the stoves around in the main, I think 1,500 stoves that we distributed. And they proved to be very safe. In terms of the study that was conducted by the CSIR as part of that program. But the unfortunate part of those parachute stoves is the cost and the fact that they were manufactured outside South Africa. And when we, during the study, when we interviewed who they using those stoves, when we asked them how much do they prepare to pay for a stove of that kind, you know, the actual cost of the stove was sitting at around, I think, 700-800 per unit. But the people say they were prepared to pay between 150 and 200 right, for those kinds of stores. So you're quite correct to say maybe the issue of how we then make sure that we have in providing this appliance to the community. What you also find out during the study of that some of the household, they use the stove mainly because paraffin was provided free as part of the study because we wanted to make sure that they use the stove. So they use the stove because paraffin was provided free. Some of them, not many of them, of course, they took the stove and gave to the uncle somewhere and so forth. So those are some of the challenges we have now. The issue is when you embark on a program like that where you now subsidize the appliances, the distribution of the appliances, how do you make sure that the appliances are used for what they're supposed to be used for and so on. But you are quite correct because in most countries where they are moving away from subsidizing the fuel and subsidizing the appliances because it makes more impact on the appliances than on the fuel itself, because on the fuel it can be subsidized in the wrong people. But on the appliances, at least you know that the appliance is given to the person who needs that appliance. But it's not as easy as you are putting it. As you probably rightly say, we need that strategy, household strategy that we probably will talk to our colleagues in policy to say, this is what the members of parliament are proposing. On the LPG price, I think you tried on the issue of need proper filling price. I think you are taking your comment. As I said during my presentation, our colleagues in pricing are mainly tasked with this one. We are part of the team that is looking at the review of the current fuel price, including the maximum refinery gate price, the transport cost, and where that wholesale level should be regulated as well and so on. So that is under discussion in the department. When did they have a workshop with the industry? Last month or a month ago on this issue, so it's being discussed and considered. I don't want to go much on the issue around deregulation and the role of Sasol, but I think it's enough to say at the moment, because of their contribution, even though they are using local resources, but because of their contribution in the market share, it's still very low. So in the main, we still rely on imported crude and finished products. The only time we'll have an impact on our pricing mechanism, firstly, is if we can have equity crude, what people said was equity crude, of course it's costly to buy upfront, but once we have it, it can also mitigate against high prices, high crude oil prices. But also, we talk about the shale gas. Once we started producing shale gas, so if the combination between Sasol and what is produced through shale gas is more than 50% of what we need locally in terms of producing finished product, that could then have an impact on our pricing system because we can then change from import parity pricing either to even have export if we will be exporting at the time. Particularly if Mutombo come on stream as well, then we have now planning capacity to even export product. Then we can change our pricing system to export parity pricing by combination of the two, depending on how much we get locally and how much we import in terms of crude oil. So that's the only time we have an impact when we have more localization. You know, we have more local products coming at a fixed stock. But we can debate that, Honorable Craig. Issue around pig oil, I think, Chairman said, we don't want to debate too much on the pig oil. As you said, it's confusing because we had one, person coming and say pig oil is coming, and everybody starts panicking. Then thereafter, somebody says, no, there's enough discoveries of crude oil, and even marginal wells are going to be discovered and so on. There was not an impact. So at the moment, I don't think it had a lot of impact on the price itself today. But I would like to believe that in the past 2 years, when this issue was topical, it had some impact on the crude oil price itself. The issue of the Australian Commission, in terms of how they ensure that there's no price collusion, Basically, what they do, I think there's a slide that we can share if that we attended one of the courses. It was presented and it was given to us as a case study. But this is not a recent study. I think it was done 5 years ago or so. But what they normally do, they look at the import parity pricing element. You know, how much it will cost to bring the product to the Australian market, and check if the oil companies or whoever is selling in the country is complying with the existing price in the market, so that they don't come with their own element and then inflate the final product. So that's basically what they do. They don't necessarily look at the, obviously they look at the final price in the retail certification and so on, but they are focused mainly on the build-up of that price, to say what are the elements that are building up the price. Is there anything that concerns us within the elements? Then that's how they control and make sure that there's no collusion. But really, to avoid collusion, you need a lot of chaos in the market so that they can compete. You know, hence we find it as a challenge in South Africa. We don't have a lot of players in the petroleum industry. I think the point is not accepted on the fragmented regulation and how it impacts on the economy. One of the challenges we have as well is to, before we introduce regulation, to say what is the impact on the economy. And I think, in my view, this is an area where we need a lot of independent work or study or research, not by industry, not necessarily by government, because we don't have the resources to focus on research. We'll be doing other things as well and so on. So this is where we need to bring researchers, you know, people who are doing honors or masters with universities, and see how we can fund them, the government, to help us research on some of these issues, particularly the regulation of diesel in particular. Any regulation that we're thinking of, what is the impact, so that we can have a detailed research study that we could base our decision on. Because at the moment, somebody will come and say this will be the impact. We don't know the assumption that those people are making, what kind of study they've conducted. Some come with their own self-interest, of course. We know that. So that's why, for me, you know, I will think that we need independent research studies. The advantage, of course, as we know, these people don't have to be supervised by the department. They're supervised by their professors. The department is only involved in looking at the report, interrogating the report, making inputs, and so on. So it actually does not require a lot of effort from department officials to be involved in this kind of thing. And you can get good work, you know, in my view. The issue around the levy and separation from the main levy, and why I'm sure Talan here, my colleague from electricity, probably will talk to the issue around why electricity levy act is not here. But this is really how probably if you look at the pipeline levy act, how we collect levy for the pipeline, the tariff that NERDA is going to charge and so on, because it's regulated at the end of the day, the product is regulated. So we said, in order to collect the levy, then there must be an act to say, how is the levy going to be collected, how is it going to be administered and so on. Same thing with the Gas Act levy, the same thing applies. I think it's also related to the levy that we talked about, the incremental inland transport recovery levy, you know, to say, you create if you like, regulation to say how this levy is going to be collected and administered, and if it's going to be distributed, how it's going to be distributed in the case of the incremental inland transport levy. But I think now you can know the issue that you want to add on, so that when I'm done, then you can add on some of those issues. Then the issue around
health answer, I think the black color number that you keep on the mind. Never mind. Is that one way or another, efficiency in any sector is very important. If inefficiency is creeping along the way, like the regulatory and the legislative mechanism in this sector, you know, quietly, that will definitely have a negative impact down the line. That's what triggered in my mind. I'm still neutral for now. You said that. Maybe a naive question is that, wouldn't this be creating some inefficiencies when you have levy at one side and the other act on the other side? I don't know for now, but it's just a naive question. But on the overall, also we should alert to the fact that we should ensure along the whether the supply chain on the overall
the mosaic to keep on probing, checking, hunting for all these inefficiencies so that we ensure the department or whoever it is, you know, ensure the cleaning up. So it's not really long-winded, but just to see what triggered me on this matter. Thanks.
Thanks, yes, because I would also like with our legal section, the bills that are raising around these levies and the main act. When it comes to December, October to December, in terms of margin adjustment, the main reason really for the shift from October to December is when we started discussion around the regulatory accounting system in 2010, which we started implementing in 2011. Really because the information that we required from the industry at the time, they could only provide it, and we could only finalize discussion around it by December. So we have been adjusting in December for the last 2 years. So, but however, Chairperson, in as far as addressing regulatory lag in pricing adjustment in general, we are looking at a way of saying how can we then adjust this margin either once in a year or even if you like earlier in the year. So the team that is looking at the RAF manual and guidelines, which will then provide advice to the department to say how can it be best done, you know, in terms of the margin adjustment, so that we also at the same time avoid the regulatory lag, but we also then comply with all the adjustment that needs to be done. In as far as the one for April, unfortunately we cannot change that one at this stage, because the Minister of Finance only announced in February budget vote speech, and then he also indicated that it should be implemented in April, in the pricing structure in April. The issue around the BSP, why is it a net lag process? I also had the same question, but I think Mr. Bagler also advised us, because he was part of the team that participated in this process, why was it taken to net lag and not just be regarded as regulation by the department to regulate fuel prices? Because the challenge now, Chair President, is anything you want to do on the working rules, you must then relate back to the net lag process again for them to then make changes to whatever will be proposing. But I think Mr. Bach will also address that one at a later stage. The issue around demurrage, Chairperson, I think I also want to distinguish between crude oil and finished product. Crude oil is not subjected to demurrage when it comes to the SBM. Demurrage is only applicable to finished product. Remember our import parity product. Import parity pricing is really on the finished product per se. So that's where the main issue is. But in as far as the crude oil is concerned, there have been a lot of issues around the vessel coming and not being able to offload, because the way it's arranged and the way the oil companies bring the product, and also the fact that they can bring bigger vessels. Because the SBM is right in the middle of the ocean, so they can bring bigger vessels to offload. So it has never been an issue, so to say, on the crude oil. Demurrage only applies to the finished product. The issue around the flake levy, I think Mr. Bagler will also cover the issue of the flake levy, why the 250 million threshold, what really informed the 250, so if you can cover that when you address this issue. Then the transport cost, you talked about 2%. If you look at the diagram that we showed, this really talks about Gauteng. You know, so the 2% is only the differential, the zone differential for Gauteng. So surely, if I had to put in here a real price position for Toyando in Vesa, if you like, or if I could put one in for the Northern Cape, Port Noros, if you like, obviously this number will be different because the cost of going there is higher than what it is in Gauteng. Then the issue around the IP, removing the middleman, how is it going to be done and so on. As I said, the study that we got from the Small Business Advisory Group of the Investor Purchase Group, really what they're proposing is the formation of energy shops or energy cooperatives closer to where the paraffin market is, where the paraffin is used. And then we get the supply, mainly the oil companies or the main suppliers, supplying to these energy shops.
so that it don't supply to somebody else who then takes it to another person who then takes it to the
final end user.
To the final end user. So that's how we cut the middleman. That's more or less a similar process that the IECs are operating on. Because it's an agreement, integrated energy centers, because it's an agreement between the oil companies and the community and government. So the oil companies deliver directly to the energy center. So there's no many people involved in between. Hence, the energy centers are able to sell paraffin at the right prices. Then the issue around the frequently asked question, you've noted the question that you raised, Chairperson, the impact of refining upgrading. Refinery upgrading and the impact of improving household appliances could add to the frequently asked question. Remember, clearly, I think we talked about coastal storage of 25 days to say what happens if it's exited. If it's exited, the point is on our pricing system, we can only compensate you for 25 days. But the reality on the ground is that most of all these, in fact, all these oil companies, They don't keep products for 25 days. They are taking to the market and selling. So there's none of them that is even keeping products for 20 days. So that's a challenge that we need to also address when you look at strategic stocks and so on and so on. Because it's in the interest, of course, to sell the product rather than keeping storage. I think we corrected the issue that the professor is around the pricing for IP. Yeah, I think I've covered most of your questions. I think Einberg, you can deal with those two or three questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm just going to add to some of the reply on the questions that have been raised. First one is on price moving. Have we considered that? Mr. Chair, yes, the DOE and National Treasury in 1998-1999 had done a major study on price moving. And the finding coming from that study is that we did not go ahead with price moving at all. What do you should have, if you implement price moving, you need, at that time, you need about 2 to 3 to 4 billion rand sitting somewhere in a bank account, which you can administer to pay for the price moving purposes. Now, to give an example, if you look at the undercover we had in July, that was about 20 cents on MOGAS for petrol. If you have a 20 cents undercovery on diesel, it translates into 1 cent under recovery of petrol diesel. It translates to nearly 20 million rand a month. So if the under recovery gets bigger, that amount of money that part just gets bigger. At a point in time, you don't have enough money to fund. It means you need to then increase the lead somewhere else, which you have a system of price control. So based on that investigation, the DOE and National Treasury has not, went beyond that to recommend a system to be implemented. Mr. Chair, going on the people question, it's the valid question on, where do we sit with sustainable stocks of crude. The problem is not really, how many crude is available in the world. But the question is the quality of crude. What type of crude is available? And what you find would be the light crude, the heavy crude, the sour crude, the sweet crude. It's a type of crude which is required by the refining industry. Refiners got all refining operations for a certain crude diet. It's got other light crudes or heavy crudes. If you look in South Africa, most of the refineries are on a light crude, Arabian white crudes. to live with the sense of authenticity or sense of the thought is not an illegal. It's not discipline, efficiency, right? But it's not a question of this kind of crude available in the world. It's what type of food. Another problem with peak work is the extraction cost of crude work is very, very high. It's more and more difficult to extract oil from the wells, and that gets very, very expensive. And in future we could probably see low cost increases and the price of crude as well. And on the data process which we have followed in 1994, at that time cabinet decided that the total industry, all the regulatory framework in terms of the industry, how does the department regulate the industry at that time, has to be taken to ADAC. You will recall that at that time, the SASOL and PETRO-SA, or the synthetic fuel industry, were subsidized. They received what they call a tariff protection. There were a lot of arguments about that. There was a lot of arguments about how we keep the prices. On a number of issues related to the industry regulatory framework. And every of them requested the DOD to consult with organized labor and organized business in the data. We've extensively debated all matters relating to the regulatory framework of the industry. And that's one of the main things that came from those negotiations is that the termination of tariff protection that was afforded to the central industry, including PETRO-SA, the changes from ad hoc price changes to monthly changes in the price system, and the movement of the price calculations done at safety to our limited, to present it as an independent body where the industry cannot play a role in manipulating the price. So that was some of the actions that came out of the NITAC negotiations. So it's important for us to, again, when we change the VFP, to go back to the NITAC format. Okay, this is where we are. This is what we propose to be just to be able to change. Then on the crude oil demurrage, as the market indicated, we don't set the prices based on crude oil. You know what? The product prices of the BFP calculation is the the deemed import parity price. Now, that price is a refinery gate price. This is what we believe the cost is to refine product into that. It's a deemed import parity price. You can also say it's a deemed refinery gate price in South Africa. That's the price we pay as consumers to the refining industry, as you be. Now, if they bring crude into the country, all the costs related to the importation of crude, the refining of that crude, all the refining operations, they need to find it through the BFP. To either beat the BFP or you make a loss. The BFP is there only to force our local refining industry to compete price-wise with major export-orientated refineries like Singapore, in the Med, and in the Arab world. And for them to be efficient as possible, if they want efficient, they cannot beat the BFP, which their consumers pay. They will go out of business. So they need to finance whatever they pay to bring in the crude. Whatever they need to pay to the National Port Authority in terms of tax, they need to recover that from the BFP. And unrespectfully, the Tridham value of 250 million rand. At the time when we concluded what we call the self-adjusting state levy mechanism rule, we had come up first of all with a band of, value in rand terms, and then compare that to the cents per liter state levy. At that point in time, the oil industry indicated that to the DOE that they are willing to carry a negative balance of 250 million. I'm happy with that. As long as if the state balance is negative, but it is below 250 million, it means that they are out of pocket 250 million. They were happy at that time to carry that loss and to carry that under recovery. And that's why we started the threshold only or implement a state if the negative state balance goes beyond that. So they're in agreement with industry on what they felt as they could carry as industry as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the issue around the just one point on the smoothing, price smoothing mechanism, I think the challenge we really have is where do you get the funds to do it. You know, at the current moment, in our transparent pricing system, is that if the price goes down by 50 cents, the full benefit goes to the consumers. Now, will the consumers be willing to pay some portion of that money into the state, the smoothing mechanism fund, so that when the price goes up, we can use the same money that they contributed to start increasing the prices. So it's a real problem of funding. If we can find a way on how to fund it, maybe something that we can start the discussion in the department. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The problem that we are having in South Africa is something and not being sure of where we are going to go. We've got those stoves which were manufactured outside, and we were not sure of the market timing when we were distributing. And the very same thing is also now happening with the solar water. We don't have manufacturers in South Africa. Why can't we go out first, research, bring those things in here, bring the people who can educate people or train people to do the very same things that we want to distribute to people before we start distributing things which we don't have in the country. Thank you.
I partner if you want to respond, but I thought it was a pilot, in my understanding. But if you want to comment at the market, we've got to go for the break.
Chairman, yeah. Just a quick comment. I think when this project was started, it was funded through the Central Energy Fund. They clearly said to government it would be possible to set up local manufacturing capability for these stores. They had discussion with the DTR. When the pilot project was completed, the challenge now that we have as government was to say we're going to fund this. So between ourselves and DTR, we could not really agree because of this competing interest in the country that needed funding as well. Others were saying, do you really want to prioritize this parachute stores or prioritize other things that are required in the country? That's where the project died. But the idea was that these stores would be manufactured locally and create more jobs.
What about the overall energy policy?
Well,
yeah, so go for it.
No, I mean, the discussion when you say you were in the practice
I mean, that's so down now. I mean, it's a crisis in the section, and while it keeps coming up, and for many years now, in fact, we've brought this up to the committee, that we urgently need a household energy strategy. I mean, why is it that we're not concentrating on this sector? We can't have piecemeal little pilot projects. We need to understand how we do a phase transition, how we clean up the value chain of paraffin, and how we get people onto better products. I mean, that has to be the work of the department. And I mean, it's just unacceptable that we haven't got this strategy yet.
Right, there you are. But, you see, I was about just to share something with you from the Japanese ambassador, that I don't know what to talk about, but we went to the issue of, you know, paraffin appliances. And he said, look, we do have, you know, in Japan, you know, upmarket families, households, they have high quality, you know, paraffin heaters. I mean, in a place like Japan, you know, it reinforces what the department was doing, which I didn't even know, you know. But I think at the end of the day, you know, if you take a few steps back or sideways, you see, what is the energy strategy and policy, you know, guiding us in the thing? Because there are various energy carriers, you know, and some of them are more accessible to various, you know, social strata in our, you know, society, like paraffin being so accessible. But the issue of cleaning up the value chain, you know, is very, very important. And I do concede that the remark, it's not on the shoulders of the Department of Energy only, but also it links up to, you know, other departments, you know, whether it's health and whether it's economy as well, you know, economy, you know. And you can even see that what Mamatibala saying, you know, that of ensuring localization, you know. The extent to which, when you take up an issue, localization is factored into the process, you know. Surely also in keeping our culture in the current political dispensation, I would have loved to have heard that, you know, this is the role that business played, you know, during the pilot, you know, putting them in and letting them have, you know, quite a, you know, an exposure, so that at the end of the day, at the end of the pilot, particularly assessing the pilot, they would have made an input and said, look, we feel that, you know, this is doable, and this is the basis on which, you know, local manufacturing of this paraffin stuff is doable. Probably, you know, that's one of the, you know, approaches that we can explore, you know, on this one, because paraffin is not about to go away, but then paraffin is not about to go away. We have to clean up the value chain in various forms, you know, whether it's policy and whether it's other aspects, that of introducing, you know, mechanisms, you know, that make it more accessible, healthier. You know, accessibility at the time is not just about making sure that if something is available in quantity, but also the quality of it, that is, you know, health component, you know. My members, we can go for hours on this. But I'm glad it has provoked a lot of thinking and responses, sensing from the questions, you know, we have, you know, asked today. And I think we can agree that from now onwards, you know, when we handle energy issues, when we look at the socio-economic well-being of the country, you know, today's input, you know, has put us on a better pedestal. On behalf of the Parliament, obviously, but we love the National Assembly, that we can be able to grapple and further make input in the future on, you know, energy pricing. But we're looking at liquid fuel for now. And the remark, this is not the, this is just the beginning, you know. Surely some of the things may even follow up in terms of pricing, because there's some time now, you know, one is left to do this year. You know, in future, you know, what significance and impact of these markets, you know, to operating in various forms. You know, some may be local, at home, regional, continental. The continent is growing, and even global in the response. And I mean, NASA made a determination very recently on the LPG. You know, one of the blockchains had a little bit of that. We have a DSP for petrol, we've got maximum price for paraffin, we've got another thing for another one, and you know, I'm sure never the people who will keep on interrogating what informs these various concepts, because it's different tools for these given careers, you know. Our interrogation inputs and contribution would end up having a better pricing formula in the future. There's another thing with pricing formula that sacrosanct. They have to be improved. I know, I remember some time ago, one effective told us that, you know, even when it comes to electricity pricing, you know, even our current pricing formula, you know, should be put on the table and subjected to some scrutiny. Not intimidating in that order. But the first one, success, you know. So on that basis, thank you very much, Jeremake, and the team. Let's take a break on the members and come back for the electricity part. Electricity pricing. Without wasting any time, and I hope to hand over to Nadia Odette to take us through its resolution.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be presenting the electricity aspect of energy pricing. So what we have done in our presentation is we have split it into four, actually three key areas. The introduction, which is mainly to provide background. Background in terms of the enabling policy in the electricity space, as well as the legislative mandate. We then deal with the current policy position as informed by the current realities in the electricity industry. And we split that mainly between the utility being ESCOM, as well as on the introduction of independent power producers. We were asked specifically by the Controller Committee to also focus on the current pricing methodology. Without going into too much detail as to how that method works, we have about four slides that we will discuss. Additional to that, to mention that in the electricity pricing space, we have an independent regulator that the department at all presentations relating to electricity pricing, we make mention of that. We do not regulate the pricing mechanism. What we do is we provide policy guidelines, we provide legislation instruments to the regulator. The independent regulator is guided to the regulator. Of course, time and time again, things change. When that happens, then the department needs to go back and improve the existing policy in order to assist the independent regulator to apply the policy. We do not, and I will repeat that, we do not regulate the electricity tariff in South Africa. And it's important that we say that to the market so that there is a clear separation between the regulator and the policy setter. I will also touch on the, I won't say controversial, but upon the passing of the electricity pricing policy, what we did at that time is we allowed ESCOM to re-evaluate its existing assets. And I will touch on that, but not in too much detail. I'll explain the rationale behind that asset re-evaluation. Then we will deal with some conclusions and I'll close in the market. The enabling policy for the electricity pricing. In 2008, the department passed an electricity pricing policy with specific tariff setting principles. What I've done in this presentation, I've highlighted about five, which are key. Obviously, there are more. We look into the document and spend much time on it. But I've highlighted, for the sake of today's presentation, I've highlighted the five that I think are key for our discussion. The first one is we give the opportunity to the independent regulator to select a specific methodology that the regulator deems fit. There's a wide range of methodologies, tariff setting methodologies that the regulator can choose. And we leave that decision to be made by the regulator, because the regulator is the one that will be regulating the tariff. So they need to do their own assessment of the industry and come up with a methodology that is suitable for the industry. What we say in the electricity pricing policy is that whatever that methodology that is, it must allow for a full cost recovery and a reasonable rate of return on the asset fee. So those are the guiding principles, that full cost recovery is embedded in the EPP as well as return on asset, which is reasonable. The second principle I have extracted, that's in a bullet format for point number two, without putting the sentences here. And the issue that I wanted to uplift from that is the revenue requirement of the entity that is being regulated is important. These entities, they rely solely on revenue for the current data code and to plan for future plans. There needs to be a clear cost reflection on the tariff. In other words, at the wholesale point, all the costs must be reflected. We don't allow for costs that are not justifiable, that are not efficient, and that are not reflected at the wholesale level. All costs, they must be transparent, they must be documented first and foremost for the regulator to have access to, and for the general public to be able to have a sight to. Obviously, some of these are subject to contractual obligations. We encourage advancing of these costs as much as possible. And when a customer receives a bill at the end of the month, we encourage the service provider to have, for each cost, there must be a line item so that we advance them as much as possible. The EPP allows for a non-discrimination tariff setting. In other words, you don't discriminate households based on their economic standing. This must not be confused with the principle of cost subsidization, which we will talk to. Access and use of the grid is also encouraged in the pricing policy. The last point there, the long-term price outlook. Yes, this is what the policy says, but in the MIPD2, it was difficult for the regulator to project a 20-year price path, for example, and precisely because there was no long-term electricity production plan. 2010, we promulgated an integrated resource plan, and now it is a 20-year policy position. So this now, is giving the regulator enough instruments to have a long-term price outlook. The third principle there is that, as this revenue that the same provider is allowed to collect, included in there will be a certain cost for the improvement of technical improvement of the plant as well as the economic efficiency. So in other words, your maintenance cost principle is also encouraged in the EPP. We don't only put a tariff that seeks to raise money to repay off the borrowed capital. We also encourage long-term maintenance of these assets. Precisely because we want them to be sustainable. The information that from time to time might be required, especially by a large customer user, the principle is that whenever that happens, when a large customer or even a smaller household requires information, that information must be provided to that customer regarding the cost of providing the customer with energy. Undue discrimination of races, we explicitly in the electricity pricing policy say that the methodology may permit cross-subsidy of tariffs. And currently, as we speak, there is a cross-subsidization in the way that the tariff is set. So those are in terms of our policy priorities. So from policy now, to enforce that policy, we have a piece of legislation, Electricity Regulation Act, which was passed in 2006. This mainly what it does is it gives the regulator the legal power to implement the policies emanating from EPP, electricity pricing policy. The regulator, therefore, they have a legal basis that they can then enforce the existing policies. There is an issue between, especially when it comes to regulation of municipalities, that there seems to be a contradiction in the constitution between what falls within the regulator mandate and what is the mandate of the municipality. And to put an example, this constitutional mandate for the municipalities is one of the reasons why the establishment of the REST could not be fast-tracked because of that constitutional mandate. So currently we are implementing Electricity Regulation Act through NERSA, with that existing contradiction in the constitution in terms of giving the municipalities a mandate to reticulate gas and electricity. So some municipalities work whenever they don't want to fully comply, then the issue of the constitutional mandate to be raised. But I must say that through engagements with them, we have managed to resolve some of the issues that they had raised. So I will move then and recap the policy position. What informs the current policy position is that since 2008, we passed electricity pricing policy. Between 2008 and today, a lot has happened. And we have not fully revised the electricity pricing policy. Instead, what we have done is we have, through cabinet, made certain policy announcements to guide the current status of the industry. We have new independent power producers. We have ESCOM built program. We have the ESCOM related financial issues due to the delays in the build program. So to address all of these, we had to, from time to time, make some policy pronouncements. So what I'm trying to cover here is some of those I will highlight in my presentation. They are not necessarily in the EPP, but we have developed them. Obviously, the ultimate point is to migrate to revise the full revision of the EPP. We have emphasized that the allowed cost should be efficient. We are encouraging both the IPPs and the utilities that whenever the cost is considered to include it in the tariff, the regulator must ensure that they have internalized, they have interrogated that particular cost to ensure that all the inefficiencies are stripped out of that. That's why you find the utility applying for X percentage and the regulator approving X minus Y percentage. It's precisely because sometimes some elements of the cost are not allowed according to the methodology. The tariff structure is then may consist of the capacity charge. In other words, if you have a plant sitting there and not necessarily producing energy, you pay it for being available on the grid. Then there's an energy component, which whenever there is megawatts injected into the grid, then they will get paid a certain tariff. Over and above those two, there is what we refer to as ancillary services. This is mainly to support the transportation of electricity from one point to the next. It's important that we emphasize the issue of efficiency because we are in the third multi-year price determination period and the regulator is learning as we proceed. So the issue of inefficient cost, be it capital cost, construction cost, or operational cost, has come up very often and the percentages are high. So it's important that we emphasize with the regulator that the costs that are inefficiency allowed. And once they are disallowed, then it means the utility regulator will have to carry those costs on its balance sheet. Just to talk in general, in terms of the policy for the current policy provision, we have we allow for pricing of special products. This, for example, could include your demand side management program. It's allowed for the tariff, and the energy efficiency program is also allowed in the tariff. The required revenue must cover the full cost of the regulated business, and this will include the reasonable margin on return. When we set the electricity tariff, the regulator allows the utility to include the future cost for the anticipated power stations that we follow. In other words, the current build program, we have Ubi, Kusile, Imbula, for example, they are not generating any energy if they fail. But when you scrutinize the current tariff approval by NERSA, you will see that their capital cost is included already. And that is for a reason that we allow the utility to raise costs today on a plant that we anticipate will come at some point in the future. Now you can imagine if that future point is delayed further and the construction cost for the plant increases, it's got impact on the current tariff. Now what I will do next is I will talk to the generator prices. There are two types of generators basically. You have the what we refer to as utility generator, and we have a non-utility or an IPP generator. So I will talk to both those types of generators. For the utility generator, we are saying that the pricing structure must reflect the cost of supply. So utility, when it applies to the regulator, it will line by line, item by item, indicate to the regulator how much it costs and what are those cost elements of electricity. Also included in that is the cost of buying energy from IPPs. So your cost of power purchase agreement will be included there as cost of supply. The price that we pay for electricity must be based on either an approved regulation method, in other words, currently used the multi-year price determination as the regulation method that we use, and that regulation method has got conditions embedded. So that will say, for example, that an 8% tariff increase based on that regulation method has been. The IPPs, they do not get an 8% tariff increase. How the IPPs are regulated is that their pricing structure is documented in the power purchase agreement. And I'm trying to explain it because other people will say the current tariff levels in South Africa are at that low level. It's difficult for an independent player to come to South Africa and invest. That is not necessarily true because when an independent player comes to South Africa and invests in South Africa, there is a power purchase agreement which defines the type of tariff in the IPP market that we are willing to buy that energy for. So in other words, they do not get paid the wholesale electricity price that Eskom charges. Their rates are defined in the power purchase agreement and they compete amongst themselves. For example, you get all the wind electricity generators. They have one tariff for all of them, and they compete on other aspects, economic development, capacity factor, so they compete on the other aspects. But their tariff is treated differently from the utility. And therefore they approve a framework to expedite right options such as the medium-term patent program. These are short-term electricity contracts that for now and then the utility would need if they, for example, if there are delays in current billing programs. And they project that in December this year, if we don't buy something for the next 2 years, we are going to run into supply shortages. NERSA ordinarily will approve those short-term purchases, but they are intended for that to be short-term and it's only an emergency situation. Quickly, touch on the IPPs. We put in place some special mechanisms to allow for the introduction of clean energy in our energy. The cost of these renewable IPPs were approved by NERSA. The question is, there was a slight difference in the initial NERSA approach to the approach that was finally adopted. I can go into the details if members want me to explain why the policy shift from a vested feed-in tariff to a current program where we allow suppliers to bid. I can go into the details of that. We, in the renewable IPPs, the power purchase agreement that we have signed, we have incorporated potential financial benefits from what we call the carbon development mechanism. This is a fund, an international fund, that the renewable IPPs can access in order to support their capital investment. However, we have asked them to explicitly show it in their power purchase agreement so that that additional financial support is used to reduce the tariff in South Africa. The last point there, which really came from through NERSA's public hearings on MIP3, NERSA raised an issue that, you know, as things stand, we have an environmental levy. And why don't we use that levy to buy energy from renewable producers? I mean, if you look at the current tariffs, depending on where you see the percentage of the renewable IPPs is anything between 1% and 3%. So NERSA was advocating that we should use the environmental levy amount to buy the energy instead of, you know, adding that 1% on top of the existing. So once we have the two generators, one generator being the utility, the other one being the independent power producer, all of these come into one basket. But it gets mixed, so now at the end there's only one type of energy. It doesn't matter how they came from a renewable or came from a utility or came from a coal-fired power station or from nuclear or from hydro. All of it gets mixed into one basket. And what goes out is priced at what we refer to as wholesale pricing. I will touch, I think I have two slides on that. I'll touch base on, just to explain how that works from a policy perspective. The details in terms of the formulation, towards the end of the presentation, we'll try to explain something. Again, the efficiency is encouraged. And this is shown in what we refer to as the time of use tariff structure. We are trying to drive certain behavior by, during some times of the day, allowing the utility to charge a higher tariff than other times of the day. And this is mainly to assist them to control the peak demand. We must admit that currently is not fully implementable. For simple reason that you find that especially at municipal level that they don't have sufficient infrastructure in terms of meters that they can program to charge a different tariff, for example, from 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock at night to charge a different tariff. So it's not fully implementable because some municipalities do not have that infrastructure. But the idea is that you want, you know, certain times of the day, you want to control the demand behavior. The the wholesale energy price is, for example, in a 12-month period, you get summer months, you get winter months. So during the summer period, you find that there is a different tariff being applied for the 5 to 9 o'clock slot. During the winter period, you find that there is a higher tariff because of the cold. Again, the prices must cover the cost. We don't want a situation where the utility is not recovering in full cost. So whether you are sitting as a generator or they are sitting as a wholesaler, we encourage them to include, firstly with justification, all the efficiency in care cost. When you look at the current tariff structure, you will see that there are cross-subsidies. And the policy position is that these subsidies must not be exported to our neighboring countries where we supply them. So our neighboring countries, if you like, they pay a client outside the South African environment, and the cross-subsidy issue does not benefit them. In terms of the large customers, because some customers, they buy energy at the wholesale level. Most of us, we buy our electricity at the municipal level. Obviously, it's further down the chain, and at that point, there are additional charges added to it. Those that buy at the wholesale level, NERSA has determined a criteria of who qualifies to buy at that level. And that is available in the public information. Now, the next couple of slides is to talk now specifically to the formulation. So the previous slides were mainly policy provisions and the legislative mandate. From now going forward, it gets a bit technical, so please forgive me if I go into too much detail. But the idea was not to go into too much detail, balance the policy principles, as well as how it's currently being applied. We have what we refer to as a multi-year price determination. In simple terms, what this means is that the utility applies for a certain tariff over a fixed period. MYPD 1 and MYPD 2, the period was the same. It was for a three-year period. We currently sit in MYPD 3, with a different period applicable from the 1st of April this year to 5 years later. So the current period is a 5 year. So in other words, we're giving now already a 5 year tariff projection for the utility. What is incorporated in the MYPD 3 or all the MYPDs is the rate of return. So the utility will raise capital, and they have essentially three ways to raise capital. The first is they include the anticipated capital cost of the future power plant. They do that in the tariff. So they raise the capital for plants that they are still going to build, or that they are still building. They include that in the tariff. That's one way of raising capital. The second way of raising capital is that they go to a financial market and they borrow money for the same asset that they want to build. So that's the second way of raising capital. The third way of raising capital is they come to the shareholder and ask for additional equity injection. So what I'm dealing with here today is the first element of raising capital, and that is included in the tariff. The second and the third, they are also related, because whatever they don't get from the tariff, the plant still needs to be built. So at some point they will go to the market. At some point they will go to the market and will come to the shareholder and ask for more money. The rate of return principle reads that the revenue and the outcome should be equal to the efficient cost to supply electricity. So that's the first one, efficient cost to supply electricity. Plus, over and above that, because if you deploy capital somewhere, you expect it to bring you return. the regulatory methodology allows for a fair return on the asset rate base. And I will talk much to that in terms of the formulation. Now, in theory, this has been presented during the MYPD3 application. Let me not go to that equation and go to the second slide. These are the basic definitions that are used in the calculation of ELCOM's MYPD application. We have what we call the allowed revenue. In other words, the regulator will say for the next 3 years or for the next 5 years, this slide came in after, just to expand on the next slide, because the next slide just starts without explaining those principles. So I thought perhaps we need to give some basic definitions before we get to the formulation. So the regulator will say over the next 3 years, ESCOM wants to get X amount of rent because we have these many programs that they need to build to make sure that we don't run short of supply. So that's what we refer to as the allowed revenue. So the regulator's right is to say, we are going to allow you to collect all of this revenue. But how do we get to the number that we want to allow you to collect? And the equation answers that. The second part, which is important, is the depreciation. And this simple definition is that this is a cost allocated to an asset, either one asset or a group of assets. And it's a cost due to use as well as aging. So as you procure an asset, you procure it to use it. And when you use it, that asset loses value. At some point, you need to replace that asset. So depreciation allows you to replace that asset in the future, as well as to repay the borrowed capital. So the depreciation deals with two things. It helps us to repay the current asset, as well as to build cash reserves for a new asset that we're going to need to replace the existing. Typically, the lifespan of our assets here are about 40 years. So if we were to COD today, if we were to finalize building UP and tomorrow we connect it to a grid, from tomorrow until 40 years later, UP will be giving us electricity into the grid. After that 40-year period, we need to replace UP with something. So the depreciation allows us to start collecting money to repay UP from tomorrow, as well as to build some cash reserve to replace it after 40 years. So that's what the depreciation does. The third element that I want to explain is the regulated asset base. This refers to a total value of assets that the utility has. So for example, we can say that current value, regulated asset base for ESCOM is about 5 trillion. So that means that the value of the asset as they stand today. Why that figure is important? When we depreciate on the existing assets. So if we say our depreciation is 4% per annum, then it will be 4% of the regulated asset base. So it will be 4% of the 5 trillion. So that's why the number is important. Around 2008, we allowed ESCOM to review the value of its assets. Right? So in other words, ESCOM had bought the assets 10, 15, 20 years ago, and at that time the assets were worth 100 rand, right? For example. From that period going forward, the value of that asset depreciated. But because of the electricity tariff at that time, ESCOM could not build enough reserves through the depreciation formula to prepare for the current build program. So had we continued on that trajectory in 2008, we would be in trouble today when we have to finalize anymore. So we allowed, in order to overcome that problem, we allowed ECOM to re-evaluate its asset value. The physical assets stay the same, like this thing. So what happened is, now instead of this asset being 50 rand in 2008, we allow them to recalculate it and make it 90 rand, for example. And for a simple reason that we wanted to allow ESCOM to start collecting money for the future grant program. Otherwise, we would have to introduce very steep tariff hikes if we were to fund the current grant program. Chair, I will go into the current equation as it's been used by the regulator. As I've been saying, Chair, the allowed revenue, in other words, the AR, the allowed revenue, it consists of four elements, right? The primary energy, which is your fuel cost, your operation and maintenance for the existing plant. And what we have done is we have grouped the last two together and we refer to them as acquisition cost of assets. So these are the cost drivers, and this is what the regulator looks at in terms of allowed revenue for the utility. Now, some academics have argued that this formulation needs to be improved to meet the current industry status. If South Africa is to continue on the build trajectory as reflected in the IRP. Apparently, as we said, this is the formulation that is being used. What it does is that it allows the utility to recover efficiency incurred at cost, obviously with the depreciation and return being a mechanism for the recovery of original cost. So we have built in depreciation into the formulation, we have built in return on capital into the formulation. The next slide, I am zooming into the depreciation because there is very little that one can do on the primary energy. The primary energy is what you pay for from beneath the coal mines or the nuclear reactor suppliers or from the diesel that we buy. That is, it is outside ESCOM's control. The operation and maintenance, yes, there were some concerns that we might have inefficiencies in that, but I don't want to go too much into this. Because percentage-wise, if you look at on-air, there's a small figure compared to depreciation and return on capital. So what I want to do on the next two slides is to zoom in onto the depreciation and explain that there are two graphs or two approaches that the country can adopt. But before I go into that, the depreciation and return on capital, these two are percentages based on the regulated asset base. So because they are percentages linked to regulated asset base, when you re-evaluate your asset, by default, you're allowing the utility to collect much, much more revenue, depending on the new value that they have re-evaluated the assets to. For example, if your asset base was 100 rand, and say your depreciation is 4%, then it will be 4 rand per annum that the utility could collect, over and above the primary energy and the operational maintenance. Now, if we allow the utility to revise that asset base from 100 rand to 200 rand, then suddenly that depreciation cost, 4%, becomes 8 rand. Just by not doing anything else but to change the asset base from 100 rand to 200 rand. So it's important that the asset evaluation, the impact that it had on the tariff, it's important that we note it here. And as I indicated, the objective was to allow the utility to collect more revenue. There are two types of depreciation. What is shown here, although the depreciation is also the green part there is also coming down, but it's very clear on the return of assets, that is the biggest element, that orange color there at the top. So this is what we refer to as the historical cost method. What it does is, this is assuming for a power station, a single asset. When you purchase that asset, obviously the cost starts there. So you can say the cost was about 30 billion, just to demonstrate the point. So the tariff maker then will be the operations and maintenance, also the allowed revenue, the AR will be operations and maintenance, which is the blue line, the primary energy, which is the pink line, the depreciation, which is the green line, and the return on assets, which is the VSD, the orange line. So this is on day one of procuring the asset. Over time, that asset gets old. The return on assets reduces. So if you were to link this, this would be the tariff path that the country would follow, assuming we only had one power station connected. So in year 40, the return of on assets is close to zero because now the whole asset is paid off. The depreciation is almost zero. The primary energy is fairly constant throughout the period. So this is one method of calculating the utility's revenue. The problem with this approach is that this is only for a single asset. So you can imagine that you introduced one power station at that point. 3 years later, you introduced another power station, so this, there will be another gap starting there. 4 years later or 10 years later, you introduce another power station. So for example, at that point there, if you introduce another power station, then this line will suddenly go up. So the problem with this approach is that it exposes the country's economy to price spike. Right? Because if you follow this method, you're doing it as if you're not going to put in more plants to the grid. So whenever you put a plant to the grid, then the price suddenly jumps. You can imagine if you introduce a new power station or a group of power stations at that point, then suddenly you have to dump all the way up to that. So we are saying the economy cannot absorb those price spikes. And the preferred method then is what we refer to as depreciated replacement cost method. What it does is this line here is just the previous slide superimposed on this graph, just to demonstrate the point. So in the previous slide, you start with the tariff that is affecting somewhere over there. But we are saying, no, initially don't go that high, but at the end don't go too low as well. So that we try and we smooth out the retirement of this asset. The advantage with this is that at whichever point, whenever you introduce a new suite of plants, the jump is not as high. Yes, there will still be a jump from where you are, but it's not as high as if you were to look at year 27. If you introduce a new plant in year 27, you'll be jumping from just about 8 billion to about 80 billion. If you look at the same year, using a different method, you'll be jumping from about 13, 14 to about 30 billion. So the shock to the price of the system is not that high if you use the depreciated replacement cost method. The current MYPD3 is based on the latter method. So this is the regulator's approach to try and smooth out the tariff spikes that the economy could be exposed to. Just to explain a bit of history relating to, and I think this is my last slide. ESCOM was allowed to reevaluate its old assets. Like you buy a car today, you pay it off over a period of 5 years, but you're still using it beyond that period. In year 7, the bank comes back to you and says to ask you, we are going to reevaluate your car. You still owe us 50% of the money that you borrowed for the car because we are running short of money and we need to reevaluate your car. So that's precisely what happened. However, in this instance, we said we're going to allow you to reevaluate your car because we want you to get enough cash reserves for the many cars that we want you to buy in the future. So that's the differentiator that the state allowed us to do this so that as the electricity demand increases in line with the economic development as projected by Treasury, we are able to build a capacity in terms of electricity supply to support this. So that's the rationale why ESCOM was allowed to reevaluate its assets. Just to mention that from 1988 to around year 2000, the way ESCOM revenue was based was on a real return on assets. And this is a similar context to the place in the middle. The only issue with that is that you, ESCOM, let's assume ESCOM had five power stations. It borrowed money to build all five total power stations. There is a cost of borrowing that money. We refer to that as the weighted average cost of capital, WACC. Now, if you sell that energy at the levels that are below your cost of borrowing the money, you can immediately see that you are running for trouble. First of all, you need subsidy to repay the capital. Secondly, you are not building enough cash reserves for when the time comes you have to buy, to build more power stations. So that was the issue between 1988 to around the year 2000. From 2001 to about 2008, ESCOM was regulated on what we call the historical cost basis. That first graph that I showed, the one that I said we don't want to because of the shocks to the economy, price shocks to the economy, that's how ESCOM was regulated. Even worse, in some years, ESCOM undercovered in terms of the allowed revenue. They undercovered compared to what they were supposed to. Now, starting from the MYPD2, which is about 3.5 years ago, that's when the signals were very clear that the country needs to build more power stations. So at that point, the government was faced with a very tough decision on how do we raise finance for these power stations that will be needed in the next 10 years. As I indicated, there are three ways that a company finance is through the tariff. They go to the market and borrow, or they ask government for equity injection. Now, we need to find a balance in all these three there. First thing that happened is that the pricing policy was developed and allowed a company to migrate to the tariffs that would allow it to, first of all, pay off the existing assets as well as build enough cash reserves for the plants that we will need in the future. So, ordinarily, we are now, the country is at a stage where it needs to build more power stations if we are to sustain our economic growth. And the electricity tariffs are going, you know, the profile is going to increase trend. The issue that we must manage now is the rate of that tariff increase. Because it means that we are putting more new power stations, we are retiring the old power stations, and we need money to put more power stations. Currently, as we stand, in the ESCOM balance sheet, there is not simply not enough money to build, for example, the IFP 2010. So, MYPD 2 and 3, you know, we are trying to move out the required price shock. So we need, the country needs to move to a stage where the electricity tariff, it helps the utility and the country to prepare for the build program. So in short, Chair, the previous period where we are not building any new power station, it was easy for the state to use the cheaper energy price, electricity price, sorry, to attract international investors. Because at that time we were not building, so it didn't require as much capital for the new plant. However, we are now at the stage where the demand, electricity demand in South Africa is slowly migrating towards the available supply. And that's not where we want to be. So what we need to do now is to build more supply so that there is that 15% margin between maximum demand and available supply. Thank you, Chair. Before I go to the chair, I was seated there and tried to extract from the current MYPD3. The carbon test was not being seriously included in the EMIT application, however, currently not in the MIT department. There is still work being carried out interdepartmental to address how these carbon will impact the electricity tariffs. What is included here is the environmental risk, and as I indicated, NERSA, even in its own record of decision, NERSA convinced or advocated that this money must be used to pay off energy purchases from renewable green. To conclude, as I said in my opening remarks, we had in 2008 we passed the pricing policy. Between 2008 and today, we have introduced other policy instruments to try and deal with the current reality. So at some point we need to revise a full comprehensive revision of the EPP. We need to develop a long-term electricity path, and this should mirror the integrated resource plan. Now, the IRE, we revise it from time to time, so it means that the time path will be amended to reflect the latest version of the IRP. I've said it before that we are at a stage where we need to build more power stations to facilitate our economic growth operations as a country. The tariff will increase because we need more capital to build new power stations. And it does not matter whether you use the IPP approach to introduce more power stations or you use the utility approach to introduce more power stations. The only difference is that when you use the IPP approach, the IPP raises capital on its own. It does not include the capital it requires in the tariff approach. We only pay the IPP once they are injecting electricity into the grid. With the utility, it's slightly different. We allow the utility to raise capital for the power plants that they are building. We allow them to include it. So that's the only difference between the two. But whichever approach you take, the tariff is on an upward trajectory. The rate at which we introduce non-utility generators, we've been criticized before that we have, on an annual basis, we are introducing very small renewable energy megawatts. And our explanation has been simple and consistent that when you look at all these technologies, there is a learning curve in terms of their cost. So the cost to manufacture wind turbines, for example, internationally is declining. So it does not make sense for South Africa to buy as much at that high tariff. What makes sense for us is to buy and encourage local manufacturers of these turbines. That makes sense for us. And if we have a long-term picture of them, we would like it. About 40% of our energy mix, and we are migrating towards that. The question is how fast you want to get, because on one side you balance the needs of the investors, on the other side you balance the needs of the country. So the balance between the two, that yes, we want to attract investors with those technologies. On the other side we have the country's needs that need to be balanced. But I must say our renewable program is so far by and large received praise than criticism. The other issue that was raised during the latest ESCOM's MIP3 application, when ESCOM goes to the market, they would like, and I will quote them because that's what they said in the presentation, they would like to go to the market without relying on the state to provide guarantees. Now, in other words, they want to be a standalone entity from a credit perspective. So that's one element. And the country has to decide whether is that best for economy or South Africa. Either ESCOM stands alone and goes to the market without relying on us to provide them with guarantees, or they go to the market and provide them with guarantees to raise funding. The first option is ESCOM if we want Eskom to be a standalone from a credit rating perspective, it means the tariff must increase much faster than the 8% that was approved. If we don't go beyond the 8%, it means then we went to option two, where we are saying whenever Eskom needs to go to the market, government will stand behind it. And for us, it makes sense to do it like that at the point, taking into account the possible high tariff impact that we have on the economy. So currently, as it stands, there's 8% for the next 5 years. It's subject to reopener, so there are certain triggers that if those eventualities happen, then Eskom will go back to the regulator and ask for that 8% to be reviewed. But for now, all things being equal, this 8% for the next 5 years. The both methods, the historical cost and the depreciated replacement cost, both of them, they ensure that the utility recover the full cost. However, as I indicated, the preference is on the second one, on the depreciated replacement cost, precisely because it helps us to manage those potential energy spikes.
Thank you very much, this is quite forgiving, more than what we knew. Of course, it's going through the MIT district on November, and some of the issues that have been raised are not necessarily just you to us, with them, but a few features that one picks up is the issue of transparency. Which I think is a link of happiness regulatory environment, which is a very developed plus planning, which is going to become quite a feature now. Planning in terms of IRC, planning in terms of industrial planning, plan. And also even the other programs, short-term they may be the urban fields program, the medium-term mitigation, risk mitigation program, results in what I regard as transferability, certainty, not only for us, but for the private sector and investors. Much as there has been a debate on a number of things, but I think to me that also generates confidence at the end of the day. And also the fact that we create platforms to engage and be able to influence and be influenced are also things that it would create a better process of handling it, practicing in the future. Thank you very much for discussing also the issue of your channel investment and how you calculate that. But of course, the whole set of things that come in the channel capital as well, which is quite a contradiction issue. I remember during the MIT3 processing that came up, and various experts giving their own things, for example. But at the end of the day, I think this is a good termination point after the MIT3, we just have a sense. In any case, historically, how have we journeyed through moving the pricing mechanism and formula on energy? Having said that, can I hand over to members for questions and therefore speaking? I see your hand on the table.
Thanks, Chair. We don't have much time, and I mean, a lot of this initiative was covered in the hearings. In our submission, we did bring up a number of concerns with the present kind of pricing methodology. And thankfully, I mean, it seems to have taken some of those on. problem with the logic that you're presenting here to me, just in brief, is that essentially you want consumers to not only pay for the building of new assets now, but to also pay for the building up of a fund to fund future assets which will be built in the long term. And while there's also a fund, a return on the existing assets of Eskom at this stage. And I think that what that would have done to the price, well, as we saw in the submission from Eskom, would have made it completely unaffordable. And I think that that's why things needed to change. I mean, I think that depreciation is usually used as an accounting method, not as a way of generating funds into the future. But I think there were many problems with that kind of methodology, and I'm glad to see that you're re-looking at some of these issues, because I think it does need to be re-looked at. I also think we need to use the working cost of capital as a better benchmark than the kind of return on assets and that which you use. So I think, yes, we've been moving forward, and I think we've taken the right decisions as a country in terms of where the price came in. My only concern with the current price, and I'd be interested to know, is that NERSA has said that they haven't allowed Eskom certain things. I mean, obviously it didn't allow Eskom the kind of huge return on assets, and I mean, as you said, they wanted to actually have their own balance sheet. I mean, they wanted to have a better balance sheet than the country, I think. That clearly wasn't acceptable in terms of the price that they were asking for. But what they also had was specific demand-side management mechanisms in Eskom in the crisis before, which now NERSA didn't allow. And what we've heard from a number of presentations that people have made to us is that a number of companies are now struggling because they have planned demand-side management interventions, but now it's not under the Eskom anymore. And it's supposed to be funded by the department, I presume, or by Sinedi, or by some other agency. But there seems to be a lag in terms of coming and filling that gap. Is this something that you're looking at? I mean, what is the mechanism to address that, given that the ESM isn't really funded by Eskom to the extent that it used to be? The other thing I was interested in, you talked about kind of using meters and how municipalities have struggled to move across to that. But I'm interested to know, do you expect municipalities to solely fund the replacement of those meters and deploy new time of use meters? Or are you looking at some kind of subsidy scheme from national government to assist in that process? Because we seem to have hit this kind of stall process where municipalities can't afford to put in the time of use meters, but what in fact that benefits not only to the municipality but to the country as a whole in terms of reducing fee flows. So I'm just interested to see whether you've got some kind of mechanism in terms of that. And then just lastly, in terms of the, I mean, you're saying the last slide that industries in the state with more power stations need to be built to facilitate the country's economic growth aspirations, and Paris will increase as more capital needs to be raised. I mean, this is a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. I mean, my problem with the current present IRP is that what we have seen and what a number of studies have shown is that, in fact, women do think the city finally come online, but when they do come online, we will have the capacity that we need. Yes, it won't be for infinity, but we will have the capacity in the short and medium term. And so capacity won't be our problem there. The problem will be, which will hold back growth, is if we push up the tariffs too much to in fact go on a major build program, that will hold back growth just as much as not having enough capacity. So what this all points to is that we urgently need to revise that IRP, as you have said. You said from time to time, in terms of what's promulgated, it's supposed to be every 2 years, and we're already past that deadline. And all that I think this whole presentation speaks to is we have to get our data right before we go on a massive major build program. We have to see what's happening with demand. We have to see what impact it will have on price. So I urge the department to please do that before we enter into any major new build program, which will have to be funded by an affordable tariff increases.
Yes,
thank you, Chairperson. I just want to thank the department for a wonderful presentation. It really is making sense now in my head. I understand more than what was happening previously. My question is on the last part where you spoke about Eskom wanting to be a stand-alone financially. Does that mean that Eskom no longer wants to be a government entity? Thank you.
from my side, I'm afraid running to your policy management strategy currently. Please put me at ease, because my expectation is that the policy has to be reviewed and refined for the better, obviously, you know, periodically, depending on the frequency. Now, what I hear you saying is that the license policy at this stage in time has been reviewed or has been refined and improved on a specific basis as and when necessary. What's the rationale for that? Is that presenting a risk as well? You're handing the stability secure stock right now, we expect you to bring it, having been defined as an example. You're handing the transformation policy right now, we expect you to bring it, you know, being reviewed. There could be a couple of others as well. Of course, we've been checking you, energy efficiency comes into mind as well. At this stage in time, if we ever hear something, we may be quiet, we may be doing that. So just put us at ease. And of course, the highlight here is the honored members, electricity. I mean, it's 95%, you know, in its cost in South Africa. So we need to be on our toes when it comes to even policy management. Using a generic term, policy management, which includes a whole host of things, whether it's piecemeal improvement or overall critical movement, I mean, improvement. The one other interesting area is about municipalities. But here today we're talking about overall electricity pricing. I assume that if one thinks of municipalities, how might it be three covered? If not, how are they factored in? And you've raised quite a number of things, you know, vis-a-vis ESCOM on its own, you know, the dilemma of credit rating, which I did support in a much earlier question, you know, why should an entity want to stand alone credit scheme vis-a-vis product crediting by the country, you know, thanks for that. You don't have to answer for one way or the other. We'll definitely engage ESCOM on that one down the line. It's a very, very interesting and a pertinent issue. I'm just thinking that after the record test, crudely and say, would that be the same that is applicable at municipal level as well? You know, because municipalities make their own application, you know, and NASPA responds to that. Do they take into account when they do their finances and their, you know, tariff structuring and restructuring? This is the credit rating and whatever, you know. So now what is the municipal aspect of what we're dealing with today? Focus on primary energy. It's a very interesting thing. I see a graph there, it shows a constant. But can I go over to what if we reduce efficiency? This is very expensive. What if we reduce gas? Would the graph go down? Correct me, because I'm really approaching it directly, crudely. But I'm trying to say that what if there are innovative ways of improving that component, primary energy? You know, but of course, that's playing a little bit academic education. But obviously, you can see where I'm rehearsing together with a member that down the line. We may have to be quite firm about seeing more action in that area. In fact, honestly, I don't believe one member, the graph there, I think it's the pink one, could stay that constant if we put in the term any efficiency. Unfortunately, you hit me at the O&M, said it's minutes to 55, but still, one would like to see. If you want, when an entity on a member is big, you can't afford half of inefficiency. Comparing for 6,000 staff, has its inherent inefficiency. Let us be standard strength, unavoided. So we'd like to see down the line that being improved as well. I thought you said you would take us through as to why if you shift from refit to remit, even if it's very, very brief. Queen. If you could just spend about 2 minutes on queen. What is an issue? You know, how does it come into pricing? Is it just a smaller beginning factor, or you know, does it have a meaningful component? Another area that one has picked up recently, which might be a factor in future, but I don't know, may not necessarily spend a lot of time on it, is the issue of microgeneration. I know much more than anything, we need to be directing the question to NASA, because the exponent or promoter of microgeneration has said that their problem is NASA more than anything else for now. But obviously, surely, the department can make well or two on microgeneration and pricing in particular. Still a new feature, more than anything. We have another question. What controls were put in place to ensure fair representativity when a firm was allowed to revalue its asset base? I think let's stop this one.
Can I throw in an assignment first, not for the sponsor?
Thank you, sir.
I'm not sure if my one of the words. I'm interested in your issue that ends. I'm just trying to throw it back to you so it turns them into a problem of question. When you say that this is pricing, what it means to confuse. I'm speaking here, who is going to confuse it, and who is going to do that. But that's going to be the price that needs to be developed. And it's something to say, this is the plan to do that. I can go ahead and say, state policy must be clear and company understanding. When I was going to get something to say, it is not clear and we can do that. I'm not showing that. I'm not saying it's wrong with that. But to me, I'm very interested in saying what to expect of us.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks, Honourable Members. I will start with the questions from Honourable President. The third issue there that you raised is the demand side management problem. When one interrogates the current approval, you will see that there are only two elements, because the program has got different components. There are only two components that were not approved. The first one is the power pilot. The second one is the solar water heaters and the heat pump program. Now, the power pilot, the others were approved. The power pilot, the issue there was that literally the factories on Friday they were sending people home and nothing happened. They will include that as, you know, as part of their program without necessarily being productive. And that for our national treasury principle was incorrect. So we could not proceed on that basis that the state utility would pay manufacturing houses not to manufacture, just to manage a short-term demand supply shortfall, because the long-term economic impact, to those people that are employed in those factories, were bigger than the short-term management of supply demand. However, those programs that are included in the tariff, there's a different approach in how they're going to be implemented, and I won't go into too much detail, but the issue was that Eskom prices electricity at the wholesale level. So everyone in the country that buys that electricity, at a 10% of the price they pay would be for DSM, which is fine, all well and good. Now when it comes to implementation of the program, the utility would only implement in those areas that it serves. A guy sitting within municipality Y is paying a wholesale price of it because it's included in his retail. But they don't get the benefit of the demand side program because those are only implemented in the Eskom's area of supply. All those areas of supply that municipality has contracted to operate. What we are doing now is we have Eskom is still pricing that wholesale, they're still collecting that wholesale. However, the money is ring-fenced to be used at the national level on a program-by-program basis. So now it's not only exclusively for the Eskom area of supply. Yes, there might be a little bit of a pause in the market because that information is not yet out there. But I can assure you it's almost done. We have immediately started taking on a program that very soon will be making announcements of. But it's incorrect to say the whole program is now being cancelled completely. Yes, there is a delay because we are changing the how we implement. The time of use metering from the public. And this affects by and large the rural municipality. And the unfortunate part is that they now use a tariff that is something between the tariff that is approved and the high tariff of time of use. In order for them to, because Eskom still charges at time of use, so in order for them to manage that purchasing from Eskom at a wholesale level at time of use, and selling it at below time of use, they are now making everyone to pay something between the minimum tariff and the time of use tariff. What we have done is, in the Gauteng province, there is an understanding between the department and the provincial government of Gauteng that we will be piloting a smart metering project. And the whole rationale for that is most municipalities, they argue that once you install the time of use metering, once you install the smart metering that are reversible, they are likely to lose revenue because now the meter will run in the opposite direction. And we needed a municipality to buy into the pilot team of that to see how we can introduce the smart metering program without necessarily affecting the municipality's revenue that they would collect from electricity sales. So it's currently at the pilot stage. We are hoping that at some point we'll be able to demonstrate and to convince the other municipalities that there is a way that you can implement the time of use without necessarily negatively affecting your revenue collection. I mean, on one hand, the time of use will help them to collect, to put in a higher tariff and collect more revenue from the user. But on the other hand, what it could do is that if someone puts a rooftop system on their house, then they'll be able to reverse the electricity flow to them. And that's the municipality are very worried about that. You know, we need to find a way how to balance the two issues. The review of the integrated resource plan, I must indicate, internally it has started. It's just that we are waiting for the right time. And the strategy for now, which I'm sharing with the house, is that we are going to a public consultation for the IEP. Cabinet has approved the draft IEP. So at some point around September, October, there will be a stakeholder consultation, same as we did with the IRP when we did the national roadshow. And the strategy on our side is that at that point, then we will initiate in terms of the work that we've been doing on the review of the IRP, we will make that part of the initial phase of the IRP stakeholder consultation. So internally, the work has started. We are waiting for an opportunity when we start the IEP stakeholder consultation. Stakeholder consultation is going to combine to make it IEP and IRP stakeholder consultation. We have started internally and the preliminary discussions with the key stakeholders, National Treasury, your large customer. The negative issue of Telkom wanting to be a standalone credit rating from credit perspective. The rationale that they used at that stage was that instead of them, whenever they need to build, relying on the state limited resources, they want to be able to go to the market independently at the right time. And that is separate from the state being the shareholder. The state would still be the shareholder. But what is common motivating for is that they know that the state has got very limited resources and they don't want to impose more pressures on them. So they want the opportunity to be able to go to the market and borrow money without relying on the state. Which, if you look at it from that direction, makes sense for the utility to want to do that. But when you take that and balance it with the aspirations of the economy, the tariff will increase rapidly that the economy cannot afford to do that. So the government took a decision that we are going to stand behind Eskom. We do not want the state, we do not want Eskom to be a NRO entity from a trading perspective. So it's not that Eskom wanted to be disowned. It's just that they were saying that it would be much easier on the national balance sheet if we were to be able to stand alone and promote on but balancing that with the impact that approach could have on the tariff, then the state decided that not now, maybe in Southland when the tariff is at a proper level. The question that quite correct, the electricity pricing policy has not been formally reviewed before. What we have been doing is that when there was an MYPD reapplication on the table, the issues that were raised in that application, some of them were outside the mandate of the regulator. So, for example, the standalone credit rating. The EPP, the 2008 EPP, did not deal with that issue comprehensively. So what we needed to do to write the EPP in full will take time. The MYPD price application was already on the health table. So NERSA then consulted correctly with government to ask, we have the issues that have been raised by the utility. They make sense if you look at them from the utility perspective. However, we need to balance them with what the state policy says. Because of the limited time frame here, we had through cabinet to put in place, if you like, an improvement on the EPP. So we had to, and I'm using only one example of standalone treasury. There are other policy matters that, for us to revise the whole policy would delay the MYPD, which would have impact on the ESCOM creditor. So for us, the quickest solution around that was to get all the affected government departments to get cabinet to amend, because the policy was approved by cabinet, EPP, to get the same cabinet to make the same amendment. Yes, the question was asked again at cabinet level, when are you going to revise the 2008 EPP? Currently, it's work in progress, and the target is that by end of the current financial period, we will have at least a draft of the revised document on the table. But it's quite correct that we seem to be approaching it on a need basis. We're not overhauling the whole policy. Yes. The municipalities, what they do is they get affected by the outcomes of the MYPD 3 outcomes application. They are not directly, their cost is not included in it. They are just their people. However, what then happens is once they know how much ESCOM has been allowed, that form their input into the application to NERSA, which NERSA must approve by the 1st of July for their own tariff entry. And I must admit, Chair, that at this point, I do not know what their position is relating to being standalone paid entities. But as you can imagine, the municipality provides a whole lot of services, only one of them is electricity. So it would not make sense for wanting to use electricity for the whole municipality to be standalone credit rating. But we have not had any formal request from the regulator on policy directive. So I cannot pronounce on whether farmers wanted to be a standalone entity. The primary energy cost that we reflected here, the pink, this is dominated by coal. So about 97% of that is coal. Yes, operationally there will be spikes if you use more diesel than you should. There will be spikes, but over a 40-year, because it's a 40-year life cycle, over the 40-year life span, those spikes disappear. So this is dominated by coal, and the cost could go either way. They could come down or go up. For example, if the carbon tax issue is imposed, then the costs are likely to go up. Mainly for two reasons, that then we'll have to introduce technology, the carbon tax and storage, so that's a cost implication. The current approval by the Competition Commission for the claim correct measure, could open an export of local coal to the international market, for example, the Indian market, they use the same quality of coal as us. So we could be exposed to the international track. The coal could be exposed to international price of coal, and that will obviously drive that peak chart up. So there are variances that could change the primary energy picture, as it's depicted here. I guess the question is how does the country then prepare for that? How do we plan ahead with those unknowns in the equation? The rapid and the rapid, between us and the independent regulator, there were a feed-in tariff, if I can try to explain. A feed-in tariff basically says, you come, you build a plant, you will pay this money. End of story. Whatever we pay you makes you a billionaire overnight, that is for the electricity user to answer. When you look at the basis of those terms in terms of delegates, the exercise was purely theoretical. Because the first thing of the question was that, how did you come to that tariff for a solar plant, for example? And when you look at the response, it was mainly theoretical, looking at other countries, but at the time South Africa didn't have any solar plants. So for us, that from a policy perspective, that approach was quite risky on the impact that it could have on the electricity tariff. And whatever decision the country was going to go with at that stage would set the trend for all the renewable projects going forward. Fortunately, Chair, what happened is some of the lobby groups, they were not happy when the indicators were that the policy department is not happy with the feeding tariff. We want the market to compete and give us the same going forward. So some lobby groups were not happy. They consulted legally. Up to a point where legal opinions were solicited. What came out of that, senior counsel indicated that the current Electricity Regulation Act and the NERSA establishment does not allow for the regulator to pronounce on tariffs upfront. The regulator must receive a tariff application and they must approve it. That's what the law says. So the feed-in tariff, where based on some theory, NERSA would come with a certain tariff but illegal, according to the senior counsel. And when you look at it, it was not even solicited by the department. It was solicited by a market player that got worried when the department started to mention that feeding terror is not good for the country as their policy. So from that basis, we moved then to a program where we group developers, solar, wind, biomass, natural gas, we group them together and we say to them, this is the terrorist feeding, not 30, it's a feeding, you can't go beyond that. We allow you to compete below the ceiling. And then below the ceiling, we will take, obviously all things being equal in terms of the quality, technology, and all of that, we will take the cheapest guy from the bottom of the ceiling towards the ceiling. So if, for example, you bid at the ceiling, you are running the risk of not being selected to the suppliers with energy. And we have done two windows to date, and you know, I must admit that currently the program is indicating that it's working and the tariffs are coming up. So those ceilings are also being lowered on a round by round basis. So that's the difference between a feeding tariff and a tariff rate. So the energy wheeling is not included here, but to explain it shortly, what happens is when you have a generator, and in most instances that generator is privately owned, and they want to sell their power to a customer that is sitting kilometers away, physically kilometers away from them, they would approach Eskom transmission, and that's why it's not included. But here I'm talking generator and the wholesale pricing. They would approach Eskom transmission and ask for services from Eskom transmission to transport that power from point A, which is being the generator, to point B, which is being the customer. So in Eskom providing that service, it will charge them what we refer to as wheeling charges. So those charges are mainly between Eskom transmission and the generator, in most instances, say, independent generator. And we have a similar concept where you find that a utility from our neighboring country, for example, from Nigeria, sorry, from Namibia, wants to sell energy to Botswana, and they will go through Eskom transmission, and the same principle applies. The generator will pay wheeling charges to Eskom transmission to transport that power from point A to point B. But when you look at the generator point, we are not into the transmission grid yet, we are just at the entry point of transmission, so it will not be reflected here. But if we were to unpack transmission cost, then you will see all these different charges being included in that. Can you also refer to micro generators? We call them a distributed generator. This issue is linked to the time of use issue. You see, the micro generators will be embedded in a municipality. They will not sell at a transmission level. Now, once they get embedded into a municipality, it becomes an issue for that particular municipality because that municipality is the great owner, is the one that is supposed to allow access. Two issues come to the fore. The first one is that who is the buyer of this energy, and at what price? And then the second one is that, you know, most municipalities, not all of them, most of them rely on the revenues that they generate from selling electricity. So, and they are not interested in buying the electricity back. They want it out so that they get revenue. And then sometimes they cross-subsidize with other services. So once you introduce a microgenerator, then suddenly you are reversing the power flow was from municipality to customers, and now you're selling it back to municipality. Obviously, you're selling municipality to pay it back. So that issue, from a policy perspective, needs to need to be sorted out. It affects the municipal finances by and large. Okay, I think I have covered almost all the questions. The asset-based re-evaluation. And this is a concern that was raised by the regulator, that, you know, there is no yardstick, there is no test to say, fine, you've done your asset-based revaluation, because there was no starting point for Eskom to say, this is what makes sense for us to cover the revenue. What then happened is they appointed independent auditors, and we did a sample of the assets, and they adopted the number down. But the number, the final number was agreed on, and that number has been consistent, and that is what is being used to date. Prof, on the last slide, some of the things we have started, the city pricing policy for the policy position on ESCOM sustainable credit rating, that was made through cabinet before the approval of MIPDC, and the answer there is that ESCOM, not at this stage, should not be a standard of credit rating. So some of them, there are still question marks, but some of them are
thank you.
Thanks
very much. I don't know if we have time. We run out of time on this for all of that. I think in closing is that Martina is just stalked me with a nice article. It's Consumer Fair Club Councillor and Consultative Second. Yeah, stand please. Thank you very much, till we meet next week.